Biatch, and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 374. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz. With me, as always, are James Jones.
Hi.
John Lindemann.
I'm just making it work over here, Johnny.
And joining us in Guillaume's place this week, he is out on a break, we have our very good old friend, Mr. Greg Leahy.
Ahoy, hoy, everyone.
I hear you're an expert in something, Greg.
He's an expert on Yoshi.
Well,
we're going to hear about that in just a minute. I think it's been quite a while since the four of us actually were doing a show together. You're usually on for special episodes, telethon, E3 something, or one of the three of us is on a break and you come in and pinch hit. But with Guy gone this week, unfortunately, wish he was here too, but with Guy gone, we do have the kind of the classic crew back with you for RFN, and we've got listener mail coming up a little bit later, some excellent questions, but first we're going to do new business, and I figured Greg knows what he's doing. Let's let him go first.
Okay, well, yeah, so just unexpectedly today I got the chance to play Yoshi's New Island a few hours early. I guess it probably went up on the eShop over here about 50-odd minutes ago. But, I had a physical copy on pre-order because it was a really good deal. And it unexpectedly showed up a day early, seemingly breaking some kind of space-time thing about when it said it was being shipped and when it turned up at pretty much the same time. But I've got a chance to play that a little bit. Obviously, it coincided as well with when the embargo was on reviews. That lifted today, and there was kind of been some interesting cross section. We had a couple of reviews on NWR with Alex and Dan, and then it's been genuinely sort
They're
of mixed.
Pretty mixed on it.
Yeah, sometimes people say mixed when it's like everybody kind of scores it in a mid range or sub.
It's been a proper mix.
This is proper mix. Yeah, I mean you've got like some of Jeremy Parrish's review as a 4-star. 4 out of 5 review, and then on the other hand, this I've noticed a pattern. All the most critical reviews are from UK outlets, so I can only deduce that Britain hates Yoshi, and something will have to be done about this. But you are
the outlier, Greg.
I guess I am, stranger.
On this and many things, yes.
Exactly. There's so few Bills fans here as well, it can't be a coincidence. But, if anybody listened to what James and I did as the E3 reaction show last year, you'll know that I had pretty modest expectations for Yoshi's New Island based on who was developing it.
I mean, you're a Yoshi mega fan, so you probably pretty much every Yoshi game regardless.
No, I wouldn't say. I've never owned Yoshi's Universal Gravitation / Yoshi's Topsy Turvy, depending on
where you are. Oh, Topsy Turvy, really?
Yeah, I've never played that. So it's not like an automatic thing, but obviously when it is so heavily patterned on Yoshi's Island, which is one of the criticisms, and I mean legitimate in many ways, is that it's very, so sort of adherent to that template. The thing is, for me, that at least gives me some kind of baseline that, well, I might not find it as some kind of immensely thrilling kind of revelatory experience. There's a sort of bedrock there that I'm probably going to enjoy it on some level. Which was true to a fair extent with the DS game that Artoon made back when that was still going. You know, I didn't find it to be a particularly amazing or anything, but I did enjoy it as a Yoshi's Island game. So there's that as a flaw. But the reaction's been kind of interesting because there was, I think it was generally a bit more positive for Yoshi's Island DS back then. Although that was a surprisingly long time ago now when you think about it. That was more than 7 years ago, which, I guess I feel that is sort of part of what Nintendo's doing here. I mean, on the one hand, that doesn't necessarily feel that long ago to people of our age, but, for the sort of target audience of a Yoshi game, 7 years is,
that damn, covers the whole generation.
It's a lifetime, really, isn't it? You know, so it's kind of bringing, reintroducing Yoshi, I think, to people of a certain age, and that perhaps explains the conservative approach. But to go into sort of what I've observed from playing it for a couple of hours just today, work my way into the third world. The superficial first, it certainly does look better, as you might expect, on the actual device, the 3DS. I've got an XL now, by the way. So I've been enjoying but the Zelda one. It's just very nice. But
I've seen that in person. Yeah, that is surprisingly, I think a lot of the, you know, the character or franchise specific models they do are kind of cheesy, but the Zelda one is actually really nice. I like the color of it. It's, if you see that in person, I think you'll be impressed. It's very metallic.
Yeah, I like it. It definitely got more metallic feel than the gold DS Lite Zelda, which I also had. But so looking at it on the native device, it definitely looks better. But I think also they have made some tweaks in the final version compared to, say, when it was first shown at E3 last year in terms of adding some texturing. Mainly, I think what that's done is make the polygonal elements, like the enemies and Yoshi himself, blend in a bit more with that sort of handmade look that the rest of the game has. Because that was certainly a complaint when it was first shown, is it had this weird sort of incongruity of, oh, well, it's, you know, crayon in the background, but then you've got these sort of plasticky New Super Mario Brothers-ish characters on top of it, which didn't really fit in. Whereas at least now what they've done with this texturing seems to have alleviated that a bit. So I definitely think it looks pretty nice. Although I think there's still an issue of it just being kind of muddled aesthetically. You know, you kind of go from it being crayon style to watercolor to oil painting, you know, which it, that kind of jumping around different aesthetics was not something that you saw in Yoshi's Island. It was very consistent, and that's one of the things that I kind of liked about it. It, in that sense, it's more reminiscent of Yoshi's Story, probably. And also a common theme there also is the music, which it does the thing of sort of relying on one motif and rearranging it in a number of different ways, which is something that Mario World did and Yoshi's Story did, but funnily enough, not Yoshi's Island. So it's kind of weird that they've gone for that, but the problem is it's not exactly a killer little theme. You know, and then whenever that horrible kazoo instrument is involved, it's...
yeah, Alex Kalafi, he mentioned the kazoo song in his review, so it must stick out quite a bit.
The kazoo instrument is in more than one piece. That's the worst part. Oh, I mean, God. It's like, I don't know why that would be in anybody's musical vocabulary other than some sort of trolling device, but yeah, I'm not a fan of that. But there are some tracks that are more pleasant, but clearly this is the Nintendo have been setting quite a high bar with soundtracks lately, I would argue. I mean, 3D World, Link Between Worlds, Tropical Freeze, they've all got these fantastic soundtracks. This is certainly...
So they decided to take care of that right now.
This is certainly some way down from that kind of bar. But there's also some weirdness, inconsistencies with the 3D effect. It's kind of like they want kind of the layer that you're walking on not to look completely flat, like, so it looks like it's made up of different things. So it's like, oh, well, if it's a kind of fluffy, grassy area, it kind of sticks out a little bit. And then if it's, like, say, for instance, like a rock or wooden platform, it might go in a little bit. But the problem is that then it kind of looks like Yoshi shouldn't be able to walk on it. So you kind of like, can I jump on that or not? Like, you get used to it after a while. You kind of know what you can and can't jump on, so it's not really an issue. But it just looks weird. It takes a while to get used to it. They just didn't, compared to stuff like New Super Mario Bros. 2, for instance, I never remember having that issue with that, with the way the layers are. But then in terms of the actual background.
Well, that game didn't have very good 3D at all, though.
No, it was minimal, wasn't it? Just sort of, put the 3D slider on to blur the background.
Perfunctory at best. You know, I mean, not nearly as impressive as 3D Land or you know, even Zelda, I thought, had surprisingly good 3D.
Yeah, I agree, definitely. With this, I think
most of Nintendo's games use it really well.
Apart from the weirdness of stuff that's sort of on the same layer having different depths, it's definitely better than New Super Mario Bros. 2 in terms of its usage. There's a few stages you look at where it's in that crayon style, and there's like a whole bunch of different layers in the background all separated with stereoscopic display, and you're like, yeah, this looks kind of like I would imagine a sort of next-gen Yoshi's Island game to look. And then other times it's doing some completely different visual style and you feel like, well, no, this isn't why. You know, so I don't think it's ugly, but it's just inconsistent. And that's not, you know, what I would have sort of wanted for Yoshi, definitely. I mean, I've always wanted a more cel-shaded, so you know, something like Wario Land Shake It, but with that sort of childish skew to it.
What if he was made of yarn?
Well, there's that, yeah. And I guess...
I think no matter what people think of Yoshi's New Island, it does seem to be... There's a lot of negativity in the faint praise for it. But if that yarn Yoshi game still comes out this year, and if it's really good, which I expect it will be coming from Goodfeel, you got to think that will probably end up erasing everybody's misgivings about this 3DS game.
Well, memory of this 3DS game.
they'll forget about it completely.
I think that's one thing, though, as well, that in a way, you know, if you are somebody that's just like a big Yoshi fan and you're kind of upset that you've waited seven some odd years for another Yoshi game, and it's another essentially made by the same people that made the last one, and it's even less different from the original Yoshi's Island than the last one. You know, I could see that disappointment, but in a way, the Goodfeel game kind of alleviates that. To a large degree, it's like, well, this isn't the only one, you know, it's not going to be another 7 years or whatever, you know, till another game comes along.
Well, and if you look at what they did with Kirby, I feel like those guys are not at all afraid to really kind of push a franchise in a different direction, because Kirby's Epic Yarn really doesn't play like any other Yoshi's game. So not only does it look spectacular and have, you know, one of the best soundtracks on the platform, maybe of that whole generation, it does something different. Even if you're not a huge fan of it, if you think it's way too easy and just kind of boring, at least it's really different than other Kirby games. And I'm kind of looking forward to that with Yoshi, because, you know, I've never been the biggest fan of Yoshi's Island in the first place, and this quest to recreate its magic really doesn't get me off at all. So I like the character fine, but I'm more eager. I thought the stuff they did with him in Sunshine and Galaxy 2 was plenty interesting. And, you know, the idea that you could give him his own game, and it seems to be really tied down to this mythical Super Nintendo game that people love for some reason. I think they shouldn't be afraid to really stretch and do something different with the character. And I think that's what's going to happen. I hope
so.
Yeah,
I certainly hope so. Of course, we've seen a minimal amount so far. But I mean, one thing...
We've seen about 3 seconds of it so far.
Yeah, that's, I assume that's minimal. Maybe 1 second would actually be technically minimal. I don't know. With this being so similar... it's not, if you were never that fond of it, I can't see it's going to win you over at all. At the same time, you know, I think there are actually a couple, just from what I've played so far, maybe a couple of things you could say are improvements. First of all, in terms of the cool collecting aspect, you know, the old game, it had a score that added up to 100. Well, they've kind of changed that a little bit, because now it actually, you can get like the sort of, the 30 stars, you know, for instance, on the timer for Baby Mario, that is kind of like a separate achievement from the coins, which is separate from the flowers. So even, say for instance, if you got to the end of the level and you had all the coins and the flowers, but you just got clipped at the end and you'd lost a star, you know, you'd still achieved something. You still got those other collectibles, and then you could come back and just focus on getting to the end with the timer at full time, and then eventually get credit for doing all three, and then that unlocks, I think, a bonus level once you do it for every level in a world. So I think separating those out is definitely kind of preferable, because it was always something I never had a great fondness for in the original Yoshi's Island, that was like, well, you know, on the one hand, I'm kind of trying to find, I'm poking around absolutely everywhere to find all the red coins, but at the same time, you're in terror of getting hit. Or you could just grind those mini games to get the plus 20 items and just cheat it. So it was either kind of cumbersome or irrelevant, neither of which is particularly sort of great. So I think that's an improved thing.
Yeah, I completely agree with you on the scoring mechanism in the original game. I have a feeling a lot of Yoshi's Island hardcore fans will be kind of disappointed that they made that easier, because I think there is kind of there's a nostalgia for the fact that the original game is relatively easy, but in order to unlock all those levels, you have to play it at a really masterful level. And I found the gulf between what's really needed to get through the level and the amount of mostly patience more than skill required to get 100% on a level, that was a little too much for me. I was like, I didn't really think this was the best thing ever before, and now you're asking me to play it perfectly. Not a fan of that. So I mean, I'm with you though. I think breaking those things up and letting you take your time with it, maybe, or just do it on multiple attempts is very appealing, because you're going to want to get the 100% because you're going to want to unlock the special levels. Those were some of the most interesting ones in the first game.
I think it will help more people to actually try that as well, just because it's not going to seem so. The other thing is, I don't think this game has those sort of items that can give you, give you some eggs or give you those stars at will. Like, I don't think there's any mechanism for that. I don't think there was in Yoshi's Island DS either. But that was the problem with, you could say with the original Yoshi's Island, you got to play it really well, or it's like a hardcore challenge. But then, if you've spent a lot of time getting there, and then you get clipped at the end, but it's like, oh, but I have one of these items that can just give me maximum star. I mean, literally plus 20, you start at 10 anyway. So you could just have collected no stars whatsoever and still walk to the end. So it just kind of, for me, it always just felt a bit irrelevant, apart from if you were playing a boss level. So I do think that's an improvement, even though you could say, oh, it's making it easier, it's making it even more for babies or whatever. I just think it makes more sense. And the other thing is the aiming with the eggs, because I know this has been something that was complained about. I think the Edge review basically described the gyroscopic aiming for the eggs as like borderline broken or something, but I've actually sort of given it a go, because one thing I was never that fond of, again with the original Yoshi's Island, is the fact that waiting for that cursor to kind of go in the 45
degrees. It slows down the pace of the game when you're constantly stopping and then waiting for this meter to go up and down.
Yeah,
essentially,
it's pretty cumbersome.
Yeah, exactly. It is. And that's why I always used to say years ago when we did the show, God, when are they going to make the Yoshi game where you just aim with the pointer? And of course, mm-hmm. They never have. And probably, you probably aren't Yoshi one either. But, this with the gyro is certainly not as good as that would have been. But it if you get used to it, it's actually, it can be very quick about aiming with this, much quicker than just waiting for it to cycle, because you could just, it's just a question of some people, that's never going to be their cup of tea. I get that. But if you get, for me, I've just found it sort of speeds the process up. Although there was this weird part where it's like, well, I can aim really fast, but for some reason it's taking ages to take the egg out and aim it. Like, it's like this animation of Yoshi turning around, picking up an egg, then turning back again, and then getting ready to throw it. And I was like, well, what's this? Like, I don't remember it being so slow before. But I think what it is, you've got three different modes. You've got patient, hasty, and gyro. But basically, gyro contains both of the other two. But what you have to do to make him do the sort of quick draw is you just double tap the button, and then he pulls it out fast. So I don't know why they chose to handle it that way. You could have just had patient and hasty as options for gyro as well as for non-gyro, but for some reason they didn't. They just kind of put it as three options instead of four. And the combination of quick drawing the egg and then aiming with the gyro, it's pretty smooth.
It sounds a little bit like something you would have done in WarioWare Twisted. Like in a 9-volt stage, like aim Yoshi's egg, and you just twist the Game Boy a little bit and kind of get it right where you want it. And the nice thing about, and I think that game really proved it out, that, if you're really focusing on this one axis, you're not waving the thing all over the place, but you're just twisting around this well-known axis, you can get really precise if you're expecting that. Like, it sounds like in this game, because it's a mode and you would use it for the whole game, or you could at least, then you would have the time to practice it and you would feel comfortable with it. It's not like it's just kind of slapped at you with no warning.
No, you've got time to get proficient with it. And of course, the first couple of worlds that I've played through have generally been very gentle, as you would expect. I mean, a few things have kind of come along collectible-wise that's like, oh, you know, there's a red coin flying over, you better go and get it fast or it'll go, you know, and there'll probably be more of that. And that's really the question for me going forward, you know, especially reading Alex's review and stuff, is, yeah, how is the learning curve going to progress? And not just in terms of getting through the levels, but in terms of getting those collectibles, you know, how do they kind of make that, it's always the sort of the thing about a Yoshi game like this, you're looking for that challenge within a challenge, you know, of almost like a select, we talked about this a long time ago, sort of a difficulty
people
that's
feel
not,
that way about Kirby as well,
yeah, a sort of additional difficulty that's not selectable, you know, it's just embedded.
That's, yeah, that's how Guillaume plays Kirby. He's like, put it on hard mode, you know, try to find all the secrets and you'll find out that there's a lot of challenge there.
Yeah, and that's it. I mean, I actually ended up going back and playing the Wii Kirby eventually. It's quite rare over here. I think it's quite rare everywhere because it was such a late game eventually. But
I've seen it on shelves before. I've thought about buying it.
I think the thing is especially rare in the UK because it came out even later. And by that time, especially in the UK, the Wii was, you know, kind of dying in popularity and whatnot. But yeah, I mean, that does a good job of that. And that's of that kind of sort of challenge that's there if you want to seek it out. And that's what you're looking for from a Yoshi game. What Alex was saying was kind of like that there isn't really that curve there. There isn't as much development as you'd like. And so that's what I can't really speak to at this point. But yeah, you know, it seems like a solid enough start. But that really is the question as to how much, you know, I'm going to enjoy it. It's just how much, otherwise it's, yeah, as much as I like Yoshi's Island, it's never going to be you know, a complete sort of failure as a game to entertain me. But if it's going to do more than that, it's got to, you know, those levels.
I mean, you'd like it to be more than just a reasonable facsimile.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. And also just, I mean, I think the one problem is just that what Yoshi's Island, I think why it was loved at the time was because of how imaginative it was.
Oh, yeah. I mean, no, we'd never seen a game that looked like that, you know? It was mind-blowing when you saw that game, especially in motion, you know? It was one thing in Nintendo Power, but when you saw a video of it, you're like, oh my God, this is so cool.
No, it's the aesthetic, you know, felt kind of imaginative and out of the box. You know, there's a kind of direction of travel that graphics were going at that time, obviously with DKC and all that, that went, you know, very much against. And then just the premise and everything, like, oh, it's sort of the new Mario game, but it's very, very different and all that. You know, the boss scenarios, all that kind of thing. It was a very imaginative game. And the problem is when you just set out to sort of re-engineer it, that's not imaginative at all. So it inherently is not going to kind of recapture that magic. But on a nuts and bolts level, as a platformer, I'm still expecting you to enjoy it. But how much is still kind of very much up in the air.
I guess when I've played Yoshi's Island and the DS game, which I barely touch, but just a little bit, I've always felt like I would enjoy this so much more without Baby Mario. And I know that, you know, they kind of want to keep the theme of Yoshi being effectively invincible. That's how he was introduced in Super Mario World. And I do appreciate that it mechanically, it's very different than a Mario platformer. And I like that they're doing something interesting and different with it. I just don't like what they went with because for me, the constant panic, I mean, it really does kind of make you feel like a babysitter. It's like just, you know, you're on edge the whole time. Like I have to take care of this thing and, you know, there's a certain nervousness that it adds to the gameplay that I don't really care for because, you know, if you get hit, yeah, you can always go get in, but you have to listen to that sound effect and I just can't handle it.
It's the stuff of nightmares.
It's unbearable, you know, and I just keep thinking, I wish they would find a way to make an interesting Yoshi platformer that does not have Baby Mario whatsoever, because I just don't want to deal with that shit.
Yeah, well, their Yoshi Yon may deliver. That's kind of
my fingers crossed, because I really do like Yoshi. I just don't like his friends, you know, his shitty friends that he's always trying to take care of.
What are you trying to say about Poochie? How fucking dare you?
All right. Well, why don't we move on from that epic Yoshi intro? Thank you, Greg. I'm very glad you got the game early enough to talk about it here. And as expected, you bring an interesting angle on it for sure. I hope you end up liking it, especially, you know, now that you've got it. But let's move on to John. And John, I know you don't have a whole lot to talk about here, but tell us why.
No, mine's the opposite of epic, actually. It's more like epic fail, if anything. Hardware fail, you're... But, yeah, so my Nintendo 3DS My Nintendo 3DS decided to die spontaneously the other day. I often have it packed away in my bag because I take it with me when I commute to work, see if I can get some street passes. So you know, I forgot it in my bag for a couple days, and so I took it out, and I was like, well, I have to charge it up. So I charged it up overnight. Everything looked great. I didn't have it powered on, but I charged it up overnight. You know, the light, you know, turned off when it was charged up, and so I'm like, okay, cool. Let's sit down and play it. So I turned it on, and the screen's powered on, but they stayed black. So the home menu never came on. Nothing happened, but the console, it was turned on. So I was like, well, that's not good. So, you know, I tried a bunch of things, turned off, you know, turned wireless on and off, and turned, you know, filled around with 3D, and just did pretty much anything, turn it off, turn it on again, all that kind of stuff, took out the game, took out the SD card, all that stuff. Nothing changed. The only thing I managed to do was if I tap the power button, I could bring up the sleep mode menu where it says, you know, in sleep mode, you will still get street passes and all that stuff, right? And on that screen, if you hit the home menu, it should go back to, you know, the home screen with all your apps and all your games and everything. But when I try that, it just kind of shows that screen that's in between when it loads your home menu, and it says, you know, home menu or whatever, or home screen or something, and it just stays there. So the home menu just will not load anymore on that thing. So, and I didn't do anything to it. It just died. I didn't do anything. You know, there wasn't anything that I can even point to, like, oh, there was a storm last night, maybe there was a power surge. Nothing like that.
I'm wondering if an update failed.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking too, because I believe if you have the settings correct, it will automatically download a firmware update, and then the next time you turn it on, it will ask you if you want to install it. And I wonder if something in that process got, you know, screwed up on John's system, and, you know, it basically bricked you.
Well, that's the thing, you know, that's the thing. It's like the Wi-Fi that I'm on around here is I have to, like, it won't automatically put me on Wi-Fi. I have to go through a portal, and then, you know, like, I have to connect to Wi-Fi and then open up,
Had you done that with your 3DS recently, though?
Not recently.
You know, it could have picked it up at a Nintendo Zone. I think you can automatically get firmware there, too.
Yeah, I don't know. It's something that, will remain a mystery.
Well, of course, the firmware shouldn't be busting your system, but just trying to imagine what could have happened. Other than that, I think maybe it was really hot or really cold in your car when you had it in there. I mean, seems unlikely this time of year.
I don't know. Yeah, really, that's all I can do, too, is just grasp at straws. I don't know. But yep, so that guy, he is in the mail, off to Nintendo. Fortunately, I talked to Neil. Neil was able to pull some strings on in the Mushroom Kingdom.
And, he's got people, you know.
Yeah, he does. He does. So yeah, they can fix it for me free of charge. But
it was like he was telling Nintendo, like, look, if John's ever gonna finish that review copy that we've given him, we need this strike right now.
I can't even remember what game it was now.
Spiderwick. I still have to finish Spiderwick Chronicles.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did. Hey, come on. I did turn that in. I turned that in like a year or something afterwards. Now. Yeah. Now if I recall, actually there were. It was funny because you know I was going through a lot of my old games recently, and I realized that there were a couple of Wii games that I just never did reviews for. I think Band Hero. I don't think I ever did a review for Band Hero. I'm like, God damn. No, I think I might have given it away. I don't know. But anyways. Jesus,
was Band Hero the kind of like family oriented thing of Guitar Hero after it had gone like super metal?
Yes.
It was like kind of a spinoff of Guitar Hero. And the weird thing is at that point, Guitar Hero had already had drums and bass and vocals in it for two or three games in the series up to that point. But then they spun off this Band Hero thing. Because they thought people didn't understand that Guitar Hero didn't just have guitar. Like, the branding had been sort of broken at that point, and they thought, we need to, like, re-educate our audience that, hey, this is still there, and it still has the hero in the name, so it's safe to play it. And I think it was a huge failure.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. Well, that entire franchise eventually bit the dust, so that was kind of the beginning of the end.
Way past the peak when they tried this, you know.
Oh, yeah. Yep. So, yep, so that guy's, he's going off to Nintendo to be resurrected, hopefully. But of course, you know, who knows what's going to happen to my saved game files. Now, you have to include your SD card when you turn it in.
Yeah, they're gone, dude.
You didn't copy it?
I'm assuming the worst.
You're not getting the same system back. That's the thing. So there's no way for them to really, you know, that thing is, they can probably overwrite the, like, they, if they're lucky, they can basically refurbish it by wiping it and just reformatting the system memory and everything. But it's going to take all your files with it. So the nice thing is with Nintendo Network now, it's fairly easy for them to port all of your, I mean, they could always do all your games, but they used to have to take sort of backdoor channels to get that. The first time it happened to me, they credited my account with like $150 because that's how much they saw through Club Nintendo that I had spent. And then I just rebought most of my games. And then the second time with my 3DS last year when it got flooded, the Nintendo Network was already set up at that point. And so, they just, linked it up. You know, you can't do it yourself, but they can do it for you in sort of the background system, behind the curtains. And I went to eShop and it had updated and all my games were listed there and I could just download them to the new system, but your save files are gone.
Yeah, they're
gone. If you had any of the Mii Plaza games that you had paid for, those for me, those were gone too. And I don't know that there's a way to recover those because they're tied to your like your system identity or something. It's weird.
So does this mean that, speaking of Mii Plaza, thankfully I didn't buy any of those games, but does this mean that all of the puzzles that I've solved are going to be gone?
Yes. All the Mii's that you had met are gone. So you're starting.
Oh, son of a bitch. Now that pisses me off. Yeah, I mean, 50 hours in Monster Hunter, c'est la vie. But all my street pass, everything in fucking Mii's, all those street passes, all those Mii's. I had so many puzzles solved from all those PAX Easts, and I had close to like 1,000 street passes, like 1,000 Mii's in there.
And even worse, dude, all your freaky forms are dead. They're extinct. I mean, they live on in the cloud, but
they live on in your heart. Keep in mind, they have 7 hearts.
But if you really loved them, you would have set them free eventually, anyway.
Yeah. So okay, though that's great news.
So the whole episode is now over as John just ruminates
pretty much,
on his loss.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Passes.
I'm gonna take a week off. I'm gonna call in sick tomorrow and just marinate on that. Yeah. I did actually call Nintendo and set up like an official ticket. And if anybody's curious about how much it costs to repair your 3DS when something like this happens.
I think mine was 80.
Yeah, mine, now this may vary on where you're shipping it in from, I think, but I think the repair was 85. Then it was like, there was two other charges on there. One was 10, one was $5. One was likely, I don't know, return shipping. I don't really know, but my total was $100.94. So that's how much it would have been.
Wait, you had to pay for the shipping?
No, they actually gave me the shipping.
Oh, but you saw how much it cost them.
Yes. Yeah, like that's how much, cuz they quote you the price and they don't charge you until they ship it back to you. And that's when they charge your card.
Oh, so, I see.
Yeah.
Well, I had to replace my Wii once also, I don't know what was going on. I think it was a problem with the system storage on that one because the firmware started getting really slow and the SD card channel wouldn't work. It wouldn't read my SD card. It was acting very strangely and I called them and they diagnosed it and basically said, yo, your system's really messed up. We're going to have to wipe it, which means they're going to throw it in a pile and give me a different one. And at the time, this would have been around probably late 2007. I probably talked about it on the show a long time ago, but I think it cost me like $120, which seems like a lot, but the Wii at that time was $250 and was very hard to get your hands on. So they didn't have maybe a huge stockpile to be throwing around at people. So it was a little pricey. And I lost all my I lost my Brawl data. So that might have been actually in 2008. Maybe it was late 2008. I had to re-unlock all the characters in Brawl.
Yeah,
huge pain in the ass.
Now the reason why, of course, I'm paying is because I've had that 3DS for 2 years, so they got the 1 year warranty, so I'm way out of warranty. But just to compare it to repair, since, you know, basically I'm like a graveyard of consoles at this point. my Vita,
the touch of death.
Yeah, my Vita, which is also dead and has to be replaced, that's going to cost me $130.
What happened to that?
Ooh.
I dropped that in the tub.
Nice.
So
wait, pause, John.
Yeah, there's a story
John,
here.
John, explain.
Oh, there's nothing really to explain.
Well, there's something to explain.
I play video. Look, I'm a man of leisure, James, first and foremost. I want you to understand that, right? I enjoy a good bath. A nice, relaxing time spent in the tub, right? Bubble bath, maybe some soft music, right? And, of course, to accompany that is a good video game to play. Now,
John, what were you playing? What game were you playing?
Well, actually, this is the irony with my Vita. This was just
you were
one
just
of those things.
Make the joke, that's... John. You can do it. You're almost there.
No, I was not watching porn.
No, that's not where I was going.
I don't know where you're going, James. Oh. But yeah, so with my Vita, I had actually, I think I was playing Uncharted or something. I don't remember. But yeah, so, I mean, that thing, I turned it off and, like, put it down on the floor, and I splashed some water onto it. So I was going to grab a towel while it was on the floor and then pick it up and wipe it off. When I picked it up to wipe it off, I dropped it in the tub, and it was, like, in slow-mo, too. I was like, oh, like, this is me literally saying this. It was so stupid. I'm just like, I am an idiot. It was just so dumb. It was so dumb. And I mean, there's nothing I could do. And then after that, so I gave it a rice soak. You know, I threw it in a bag with rice, kept it in there for a week. It didn't help.
Nah. If you had silica gel, maybe, but.
Yeah, I don't know. Because right now what it does is I can't charge it anymore. Like everything seems to behave just fine. But the thing is, I think that the battery is probably fried on it.
So if you plug it in,
it just all that happens when I plug it in is just like the orange light pulses twice, and that's it.
But I mean, can you turn it on? Can you turn it on while it's plugged in?
No.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. That James is asking the right question, because if it was just the battery, you could play it while it was plugged in. I mean.
Yep. It's hosed. And then on top of that, too, actually, I was able to replace this. A guy that was moving away out of town, who didn't play his 360, just gave me his.
Did you break that
died
too?
6 minutes later.
I also this was like probably about a year and a half back. My 360 also died. So I have a dead 360 and a good 360. So
you're not the only one.
Not for long. Yeah. For John Black Widow Lindemann.
Yeah, I'm just waiting for my Wii U to crap out at this point.
All right, so. John, if you want to play your 360, go get The Last Remnant and about hour 40. let the chain continue. I'll send you a copy. I've got one.
Oh my god. Oh. Well, as long as I can play
it. Do you, James? I don't remember.
Yeah,
don't remember.
It may have come up on the show once or twice.
John, you've seen The Last Action Hero, right? You've seen Ian McKellen as the Grim Reaper just die, just touching people going past, just killing them. That's pretty much you. I just like reminded people that Ian McKellen was in that film.
I did not realize he was in that god awful piece of garbage.
Moving on to games that do work, I beat this week Strider on PS4, and boy, I really like that game. I think that might be my favorite game so far of the year. There's still a lot more to play, of course, but I really, really enjoyed it. I'm surprised it didn't get the most amazing reviews. You know, and I'm sure not everyone would like it as much as I did, but I saw some like sixes and sevens for it, and that really surprises me. I think this game is incredibly fun, very, very satisfying, and it suits me perfectly. I mean, it's a game with very, very precise controls. Your character has the most mobility he could have without looking completely ridiculous, you know, just short of screw attack, basically. And the level designs are so much fun to explore. There are, I mean, you know, it's not like Super Metroid levels of secret things, but that is okay. I don't think every game needs to get that detailed with it necessarily. I think that would ruin the pace of this game, which is so fast. So the secrets really are more about, a lot of them are tests of skill. You have to get through a really nasty area with a lot of saw blades on the walls and stuff like that. Some of them are just, you know, are you really observant? Because if you are, you will find this. And sometimes even it's just, you would never, ever, ever see this from looking at the level art. But if you just pay attention to the map, it'll show you where the secrets are. They're not that well hidden. But it's so easy to rush past things in this game because it does move so quickly that I really enjoyed slowing down just enough to go off and check all those corners of the map that I hadn't seen yet. And then went on to beat the game. And the last boss is really wild and very different than any battle you've played up until that point. So I recommend it very highly. I mean, it's on a lot of different platforms. Nothing for Nintendo, unfortunately. But if you like, you know, the old Ninja Gaiden games, if you like Super Metroid, I think you will probably dig it quite a bit. So I guess I can also briefly talk about a game called Broken Age on PC. And, you know, mainly I bring this up because I know some of our listeners are fans of point-and-click adventures. We did a whole feature on it a long time ago. And there's a weird history between Nintendo and point and click. This one really isn't related that much, but I think a lot of people would enjoy it because this is the Double Fine adventure game that was kickstarted to the tune of however many millions of dollars over their goal. And it took a long time to come out, and it's still coming out. This is only the first half. If you buy it, you get the other half for free. So it's not really episodic. It's just they finished half the game and said, we need to make more money, so please buy this so we can make the rest of it. And they are. They have funded it. But Broken Age is a very classic point-and-click adventure. It's not really modernized in any particular way other than the visual style, which is really wonderful. I'd say it's on the easy side, which I'm perfectly okay with. It is very charming and funny sometimes, but not often. I mean, this is not South Park. It's not even, you know, Tales of Monkey Island or whatever, or Secret of Monkey Island. But it is funny and it's very amusing, and it's such a lush visual experience when you're playing through it that that has been the highlight for me. And you know, if you're into that kind of game, it's a good one of those. I've also played a little bit of DKC, and I know, Greg, you have been getting into this too. I've talked about it plenty, and I beat the game with a friend. That helped a lot. The final boss I talked about last week was the final boss. He's a real asshole, and having a friend actually made a huge difference in that level. So we beat it together and proceeded to go back and try to look for some of the secret levels without a lot of success. I think the map doesn't always give you a fair indication of where the secret exits might be. I think we wasted a ton of time looking for secret exits in levels that have none because we thought that's what the map was kind of pointing out.
Yeah, I mean, you can intuit to some extent, but I mean, first of all, you need to be careful about which like levels you can't get to are just the temples ones waiting to be unlocked. Like, because you don't unlock those by a secret exit. You unlock those by getting all the Kong letters in the other levels in that world. So, and I think you can tell from the appearance of what that circle is inset in that is a temple level waiting to emerge. So you can eliminate those, and then it gets a bit.
Wait,
easier.
Is that one still connected though on the map?
I think it's connected on the map, but it doesn't really matter. It just branches off from a regular.
That's really tricky, though, because if you're out looking for secret exits, you might look at that and say, oh, there must be one off of here. I mean, I haven't unlocked any of the temple levels yet. I haven't been that thorough with any particular world. I mean, I'm going to, but I didn't know that's how they work. So if I see a path that's kind of grayed out on the map, I'm thinking, well, I need to go there and look for an exit. So, that's unfortunate. It's a bit of visual miscommunication on the.
It could have made
the
temple levels more obviously just separate because they are, you know, they don't really exist within the map. You know, you just unlock them in another way, and then they're pretty difficult. But yeah, I mean, a lot of the secret exits depend on having a particular buddy.
A lot of Dixie, a couple of Cranky.
Yeah, so that's kind of a crucial part of it. And some of them are pretty, like, there's, for instance, there's one on a barrel jet level that's actually very transparent. Like, you might fly past it the first time, but it's like, okay, well, there's a secret exit. But the catch is, you've got to fly through that barrel, through it with the barrel, having not died like and restarted at a checkpoint, because then you won't have your buddy when you sort of get off the barrel jet and you need him to get to the exit, you know, things like that. But some of them are more transparent than that. I mean, there's a secret exit, I think, in the final world where, you know, you just see a few platforms up high with spikes on them leading somewhere, and it's like, well, probably need Cranky for that, and you do, you know. So it's varying degrees. There's one in the water world that is very obscure, I thought. Took me a lot of time. It's just like, I even essentially had the right idea and still didn't find it a couple of times going through the level. So that was, it's not the game, you know, relative to other games having done it, you know, in particular something like New Super Mario Bros. U. I think that it's not as executed as well.
Yeah, I agree. But the secret levels are very much worth getting to, even if you just kind of have to cheat and look at a video of the secret exits, because these are where I feel, and I've only seen maybe 3 or 4 of them so far. I think there's 10 total. I feel like the game goes an extra step into kind of weirdness, or, you know, just sort of unbridled creativity. And there seems to be less interest in these levels of sort of adhering to the theme of the world, let's say. In one of them I did early in the game is one of the silhouette levels, and I thought that level was fantastic. And the design of that level in particular, I was playing at co-op, and my friend said that this one really feels like it's encouraging you to explore in ways that the other levels don't. And it uses the silhouette, you know, to its advantage to do that. It can obscure certain graphical details in the level. And so it makes you pay a little more attention to find the secrets in that level. We really enjoy that one. And the music also, I mean, these levels, even though they're sort of bonus, you know, a lot of people may not ever find them. They have, their own unique music as well. And I think it's some of the best music in the game.
Yeah. I mean, the soundtracks, first rate all round, but yeah, I think I know the very level you're speaking about, and I know why you would say that. But yeah, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, like, by contrast, the temple levels, really, there is any appreciable exploration. They are gauntlets.
Those are Bit Trip Runner levels, basically.
There's a kind of, I think you're probably right, the two sort of alternate or, you know, more difficult to find levels kind of go to the opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a good variety, and those levels really are pretty cool. They're definitely worth going after. Even if, like me, you're like, you're kind of okay on the rest of the game. It's not going to be one of my favorites of the year, but I'm glad I played through it and I enjoyed it, especially in certain chunks. Like, it's kind of an uneven experience for me. Some levels I just find really irritating, but, you know, then I'll play one where I'm like, geez, that one was fantastic, you know, and I wish they were all like that. But for me personally, it's kind of inconsistent, but still very much worthwhile, because there are many, you know, quite a few nuggets of real joy in the game. Greg, what are your kind of overall thoughts, if we could be brief on Donkey Kong?
Could I be brief? Could I? I liked it quite a lot. I liked the original quite a lot, probably more than you did, from what I remember of the conversations about it back then. So I think probably commensurately, I like this one more than you do. But, I mean, it's very much the same. There's no arguing with that. It's sort of a little better in certain ways. Obviously, I like dispensing with the gesture controls very much. I like dispensing with the superfluous blowing. The grab is less obtrusive and, still not terribly important. But I certainly like that better. I do like the different buddy characters. Cranky's not that useful, but I just think he's fun. So I've played with him quite a lot. And this is a sort of a spoiler, so some sensitive people might not want to listen. But if you get all the Kong letters and complete all the secret levels and unlock hard mode, you can actually play hard mode with the buddy characters as your one player. You could just play as Cranky on his own, or Dixie, or Diddy.
Sure.
That's cool. That is kind of cool, to get to use them on their own. And they're actually sort of, they're just better than Donkey Kong at that point, because they have these sort of additional skills, but, you know, it's
one. If you're playing as a buddy, can you get Donkey Kong out of a barrel to be your secondary?
Hard mode is one hit and you're dead. There are no buddies.
Holy shit. Okay. Yeah. I don't know that I'll be enjoying that one.
And no checkpoints either. I mean,
good God. It's called fuck that mode.
Mirror mode from the first game did have checkpoints. I think it was one hit and you're dead, but it did have checkpoints, I think. It's been a while since I played that. But this is not flipped. It's not a mirror mode, but it eliminates checkpoints, which I think is not a great idea for the hard mode, not just because it makes it even more difficult, but also because these levels seem like a lot of them are even longer than they were in the original Returns.
Yeah, some of them are quite long.
I mean, I think there are fewer levels as well, so it kind of makes sense that they'd be longer, but it doesn't lend themselves to hard mode necessarily. But I will say, having played mirror mode and hard mode for the two games, it does make you appreciate the level design in a different way. Because, you know, when you've got four hearts or whatever, there are many times when it's just like we might be jumping onto a little platform with an enemy on it where you just take the hit.
Right.
Because it's like, well, who gives
a shit? It doesn't matter.
It really doesn't knock you back very much in this game.
No, there's no, like, 8-bit Simon Belmont fly off into the water. You know, like, yeah. That's not going to happen.
You can be pretty reckless.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's... This actually seems to be a bit more generous with giving out hearts than Returns was.
Generally, if you get hit, if you can play another 30 to 45 seconds, you'll probably find a heart. I mean, they're pretty common. The biggest thing is if you get hit a lot in a small space, but there aren't a ton of situations where that might happen. And, you know, we were having a little Twitter conversation about the superpowers, which I played through the entire game without realizing were in the game, because they're not explained very well at all in the first level. Mike Sklin, Striker Obi, was commenting that he thought Dixie had the best superpower because you can add on additional hearts to your maximum life meter with her. And I said, you know, I don't think that would have made any difference in how I played the game, because I think about 90% of my deaths were just from falling off a cliff.
Yeah, it's pretty generous in that way anyway. But if you use that Kong Pao stuff or whatever, it would make it even more generous perhaps. But when you dial that all the way back as well, so you've got all the pitfalls are still there. And in fact, many times you'd be more likely to die in a pit because you're worried about hitting an enemy or something. Then it's very, very difficult. The one I do like about hard mode and mirror mode is that you could just pick particular levels. You don't have to play through it in hard. So it's like, you know what? I like this level. I'd like to see if I could do it on hard. I'll just give it a go, especially as I've got the game digitally on the Wii U off TV play. I'll boot it up, play a level, just try it, casual little thing, probably chip away at it at the next several months.
The game
months.
Has that speedrun feature also where you can watch other people's replays over Nintendo Network. So that's smart, because that way you can really go straight to, you know, if there's a certain level where you feel like I was really good at that one, I think I can beat all my friends on the leaderboard for that. You could go straight to it without having to play through the whole game twice. I think that's a really good idea.
No, I do like that a lot. And so I think it does, even, you know, if you're not somebody who's ever going to think about playing absolutely all of the levels in hard, really go absolutely ridiculous on it, you might still get something out of the game. The fact that you can use the buddy characters as single players, the fact that you can do it on any level, I think it's worth toying around with. Just like I said, it will make you appreciate enemy placement and stuff like that in a way that you wouldn't before, because you could just be kind of reckless.
You make it sound almost appealing, but I think I'm going to stick with hard mode sounding like a completely miserable experience that I will never touch. But I am really glad that's in there, because I know this game has hardcore fans who will appreciate something like that. So I'm very glad it's in there for them, but it ain't for me.
I think I would literally have to have the voice of Saruman to convince you to play it on hard.
The damn game's plenty hard already. You know, I'm not a masochist, sorry.
You do this show every week.
Anyway, well, let's move on and let's let James wrap up new business for us.
Yeah, so I spoke a bit about it last week. I am very, very close to the conclusion of Leighton Azran.
To the conclusion of the conclusion.
The conclusion of the conclusion.
Except it's not the conclusion, because it's going to lead up into the first one.
Yeah, well, yeah, the conclusion of the prequel, which is the conclusion of the games they are producing in the... God damn it.
Which, that's really weird, because Luke sounds older in this game than he did in Mysterious Village.
Well, so they did transition him out, though. In the first, maybe two games of the prequel series, he did look younger, whereas now he looks very much like the Luke from the first few games.
Yeah. So but he sounds even older.
Well, you know,
even though this game comes earlier.
I guess they just, awesome. You know, it's hard to do that all the time. Voice act that voice forever. That's hard work to be that obnoxious. But
yeah, especially when you're a 40-year-old woman.
I did like the little touch that they aged him though by this game. That he was pretty much the same character that we knew from Mysterious Village. But regardless, so here we are. I'm at, I don't know, guessing from what the story's at this point, about an hour or two from the end of the game. So I'll probably wrap it up when we finish recording tonight. So last week I had only played for a couple hours. I led off with wow, these puzzles are kind of hard at the beginning of the game. Yeah, that's pretty much fallen away, either because I was rusty or because they were just legitimately hard to start the game. I've been cruising along, probably used 30 hint coins, and I've cleared about 100 puzzles. So, I mean, it's not really putting up that much resistance. I'm actually not super involved with this game, like I was with pretty much all of them up until Mask. Whatever, Mysterious Mask, whatever they call it. I don't know, Mask of Miracles.
Miracle Mask.
Yeah.
One of
yeah,
those.
It's always something mystery.
Harmony of
now,
Dissonance.
Yep, Harmony of Masks. my problem with this game in particular was a distinct lack of mysteriousness about it. The crux of every Layton game is that there is some big mystery that's really gripped the setting of the game, and Layton and co, whoever he's traveling with on this particular adventure, show up and immediately go like, everybody here who believes this is an idiot, we're going to figure out what's really going on. It is a bit like walking into a Dark Age village most of the time, where they just did every piece of superstition they know must be true.
It seems like the storylines have maybe become a little more about the big action set pieces and less about, you know, kind of figuring out some kind of weird conundrum that's set up in the beginning, which the first Layton game very much was that. The whole game was a mystery. It's like, what the hell is going on here? And it doesn't resolve until very late. And I feel like maybe the series has evolved into being something a little closer to like The Adventures of Tintin. You know, it's really more about like Indiana Jones, except he's even smarter, but, you know, it's not Sherlock.
The first three games are all very insular. They go to a town. That town may be in a cave in one case.
Maybe on a train?
Because, yeah, there's a train trip to a town and a cave. There's another, I can't remember where Diabolical Box takes place, but it's a town. And then, of course, Mysterious Village is, it's in the name. And the whole mystery revolves around that site. In the prequel games, a lot of the series is about the mystery of the Azeron. And there's this sort of overwhelming, or this overriding mystery that they just carry along about what are these, this civilization that was more advanced than even we are now, but there's not that much history known about them, and they were considered legendary, except for the fact there's Azeron shit fucking everywhere. It's, if these people are still regarded as being myth, people are dumb as hell in the Layton world. Because they left crap everywhere. Regardless, this game is really about traveling from place to place on Earth to known Azeron sites looking for doodad of fate, and just sort of engaging in these towns for maybe an hour or so, and then leaving. And what I feel like that denies you, and a lot of these towns have a small sort of insular mystery going on about them that's usually inextricably linked with the Azeron and their legacy, but it doesn't have that deep, like, where I'm sitting there going, oh my god, what the hell is going on in this game right now? I really kind of enjoyed the whole, all right, this stuff doesn't make sense.
Yeah, it's the intrigue. You know, the intrigue value of how is this going to be bullshit? I know it's going to be spectacular bullshit, but how is it going to be spectacular bullshit?
And that trope really has sort of moved over to the visual novel genre in recent years, you know, where you've got this just bizarro setup that, you know, how in the hell is this ever going to...
Well, I know this game is going to resolve in bullshit. I mean, it's already building up the mountain of of ridiculous, insane resolution. But it doesn't feel like I'm constantly being impelled
It's just how much you're drawn into that, isn't it? You know, and then when you keep getting these like sort of clues, you know, hints at things, it just, it, even if you know it's kind of silly and it's probably going to be hugely contrived, it still kind of, it does draw you in a bit and it's kind of fun, you know, the little guessing game that you have with yourself and the game's
great. Yeah, Nessie is rampaging through town. Wait, what? And then you actually get, and you get to see it and you go, all right. So I saw it, so the game's just not completely screwing with me. What am I dealing with now? And you kind of have to make up this sort of mental process where you're like, all right.
Sounds like a Scooby-Doo episode.
Is that real, or is this some elaborate hoax being put together by my rival? And in this case, because...
It's probably Mr. Franklin from the old mill.
It's always Deskalay. It's always Deskalay. If in any of the previous games, just assume he's going to show up, and there he is at the end.
He is the Dr. Wily of Professor
Layton. Except for the actual Dr. Wily, who they had in the first few games, whose name is escaping me at the moment, who looked like Dr. Wily. Good job, guys. But see, the problem with this game is that the whole premise of the game is they're trying to gain access to whatever the Azran's great last legacy is. And they don't talk about it that much. They're just going around from place to place, collecting the things they need to get to get it. So it's really more like they lost their keys and they're looking for them for a really long time. And a lot of these places, like I said, they have these little local mysteries, but those don't really have the long burn payoff. So I'm not engaged for significant periods of time. Even if I get somewhere and what they are, you know, what the mysterious element of it is.
Well, and the one thing I would assume would be an issue with this is just this idea of kind of making it less connected, kind of more episodic, if you like, with going to different places. It's just that, you know, the game is a bit distended, you know, the element, you know, the puzzles and, you know, the actual narrative. It's not the most comfortable sort of fit, but that kind of overarching mystery usually kind of would help at least make it a bit more cohesive as an experience.
And it does feel a little bit broken up. I mean, we have, it's not a spoiler, they announced it in the press material early in the game. They unfreeze a survivor of this civilization. And you think, okay, she's going to be the big mystery, but nah, they've got her dressed like some kid in London, just chilling out in the back of an airship, whatever. And you're like, all right, sure, everything's great. Let's just hang out with this girl for a while. That's cool, Layton. Whatevs. It lacks that sort of pull of, okay, I'm going to get through this really godforsaken puzzle because I want to know whatever it is it's hiding for me on the other side. And I'm not getting that until after I had collected all the celestial fish and had proceeded to go off to where the point in the game where all the late games have to say, you won't be able to break the path you're on if you continue until you finish the game. And once I got there, you know, it all started to kind of steamroll and the mystery started to pick back up, but that's not how I like it. So to me, this game is struggling a little bit. It's still a solid late game. I feel like I hate saying this because I love the series. I feel like maybe the series, at the very least, does need to sit for a while.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah. Now that the prequel trilogy is over, I think, you know, the right thing to do is take a break, come back in, you know, 5 or 10 years with Star Wars. I mean, Professor Layton episode 7. And pick up where the, you know, where the original trilogy left off, you know, in the forward side of the timeline. And really see something new and see it go in a new direction with new characters. And I think that would be exciting. Even if it's just Luke grown up and...
It's that easy. Just age him a little bit and you're good to go. I think the lack of a consistent town, though, is surprisingly jarring for me. Because you'd make these little jaunts to London where Layton would go talk to the Dean Delmona and he'd hang out in his office for a little while. But by and large, you spent time in this one place and that place sort of became a character. Whereas in this game, you're exploring the whole world, and all of these places are interesting and unique, and they're beautiful, but you don't have time to sort of fall in love with the site.
Well, also, each one amounts to like 5 different, you know, screens, so...
Right, you're in there for an hour and you're out, and it's like, I don't have time to really deep dive into this town that's slowly opening up and becoming more and more, you know, alluring as I'm there.
I'll say one of the things I liked about the earlier games, I played the first and the third one, is that because you were really in one location for the entire game, but it was quite large, as you moved around it, you would see some of the same landmarks from different angles because you're moving within this city, and in some cases, you know, going up in elevation, and then you kind of get this vista and you recognize the place off in the distance. And even though these are all done with like basically 2D static, you know, art scenes, it really does kind of flesh out the world in your mind, and it makes it feel like you are exploring this place. It's just, it's more done in like a classic point-and-click adventure style, you know, or Myst, or something like that. But the place that it creates does feel kind of three-dimensional, and it feels like you're learning how the different pieces of it connect to each other. And, you know, when you turn your town into a five-screen jaunt and then you're out to a different one, you can't develop that sense of you know, familiarity.
The Saint Mystère might be the most interesting town in the series. That's the one from Curious Village. Just because it's pretty fucked. But I mean, it's easily the most, probably developed town in the series. I mean, Unwound Future takes place in London. So, I mean, London, in quotes. Air quotes, London.
Weird version of London.
Cause that game, I don't know. I'm getting ready for this game to go, hey, guess what? Here comes the crazy. Cause it's setting.
We're on Venus.
Oh, jeez. It's setting up all the pieces to go just completely bonkers. And I'm ready for it because I kind of love it. I like the feeling of getting angry at the game going, no! No, that's stupid. You stop that right now. Because
it's a consistent part of the experience for you.
Yeah, you are drawn to games like that, James.
Yeah, well,
consistently.
Oh, totally.
I've actually played through Virtue's Last Reward recently. I could confirm, James.
Oh yeah, that game is full of this. Unwound Future has the one where they time travel has the most. No, stop it. I don't need this. Put the game down, walk away, and yelling at it from across the room. No! I'm not gonna put up with this anymore! You can't hurt me anymore!
That game came out a long time ago. I'm gonna spoil it a little bit just because I think if you haven't played it, you probably never will. That game ends with you riding around in a giant robot fighting shit over the streets of London, stomping on buildings and people, a la the end of Ghostbusters 2. So, that's Unwound.
Okay, I want to make sure because there's another one that has a very similar ending and I didn't want to spoil it.
Fuck me.
Unwound Future's explanation for time travel is so amazing that you just sit there and go, oh my God. Oh my God.
Oh, geez. All right. Well, that's Layton in a nutshell. I mean, it's so much weirder and more bonkers than you would ever think. If you've only played a couple hours of a Layton game, you really have no idea how truly off the deep end it goes.
And if you've deep dived the whole franchise, including like the movie, just the sheer volume of fire of just ridiculous shit they've poured onto you over the course of 5 years. You're kind of like, all right, you're sort of like waiting in the bunker going, oh, okay, here it comes.
I never did see the movie. I need to correct that. I need to see that.
The movie is great,
ASAP.
But it's nuts. It's over in like 2 hours, so it's got to ramp up the nuts real fast. But like, But this point, when I'm playing this game, every time they start to sort of work the twist in, I'm like, oh shit, here it comes. And then they get to it and nothing happens. I'm like, fuck, alright, you're not gonna get me next time. But like, I know they're running out of time and one of our European staffers is like, have you gotten to where it gets crazy yet? No. Oh, just wait. And I was like, oh no. Oh no, here it comes.
All right, well, speaking of running out of time, this segment's getting a bit long in the tooth, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
And up first, we have a feature. Staff says, next new Super Smash Brothers characters by Josh Max and the rest of the NWR staff. Josh wanted to know what characters the staff wanted in the next Smash Brothers. I understand that's all in the title of the article, but I mean, there isn't that much to say. Zach had the temerity to mention Metroid Prime 2, so you can boo him accordingly.
Up next, we have a review for Yoshi's New Island on 3DS by Alex Galafi. It is fair to say Yoshi's New Island looks very nice. Alex is especially pleased with the character mods. It doesn't look as nice as the fleeting glance our ancestors got of Yarn Yoshi, but that's not really the point. The point is, Alex thinks Yoshi's New Island is mediocre and an easy version of its predecessor. And our next review is for Yoshi's New Island by Don Cooper. Could you say press embargoes? Two Yoshi reviews? This is Nintendo World Report, after all. While Alex wasn't fully thrilled with his trip to this G-Ray in Jurassic Park, Don came in with low expectations and instead has named this his surprise of the year. Remember, kids, assume the worst and you'll never be disappointed.
So does that mean that there's an X-rated Jurassic Park?
Yes, there is, actually.
Something else finds a way.
Wow. Next up, we have a feature called From Shinobi to Yoshi, the story of the Yoshi's New Island director by Neil Ronahan. Masahide Kobayashi worked for games on 32X, Game Gear. He worked on Fling Smash and Yoshi Topsy Turvy. Neil documents the curious CV of Yoshi's new director. I think I understand, Alex. Whoa. We also have a review for Pokemon Link Battle on 3DS by Don Koopman. I don't recognize any of the Pokemon in this screenshot. That thing looks like a kidney bean with a face. Who's making these things, and why? Every day they come into work and put faces on items, give them pun names, and call it a day. It's like a Rareware that never died. Regardless, what I do recognize is a sorting puzzle game for a portable game system, and what Don recognizes is a good time.
It all wraps up nicely. Lastly this week, we have a feature, NWR's 15th birthday, the best games of the past 15 years. It's March, so it's time for brackets. The NWR staff spent something like 12 hours hashing out the, quote, best games for each of NWR's 15 years, plus a few wildcards. Fun fact, I led the charge that resulted in Dual Destinies beating out 3D World for one of the 2013 slots. Go see our seeded matchups and vote for your favorites. If you can take the time to vote for your local trash collector, you can vote for Ogawatter 64. I'm not above ballot stuffing.
That's a really cool feature. It is celebrating the 15th anniversary of our website, so we really hope you will go check it out. People putting a lot of work into that, and the more people participate, the more fun it is. That's how it works. So please check out all of this original content and the big feature over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. It is time for listener mail. We've got a ton of emails lined up, some really, really good ones lately, and always want to thank people for writing in. It helps us make this show, man. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com, and Greg has the first letter.
Clifford writes, I recently heard some sad news about one of my favorite games growing up on NES, Contra. I posted a Miiverse comment asking why for two generations did we only get Super C and not the original classic. The story I heard is that the Famicom version of Contra has some cutscenes that Konami does not own, and it would be too expensive to release it in Japan. There is a policy that if Japan doesn't get it, neither does the rest of the world, even though there are no cutscenes in the American and European versions. Can you confirm the mystery behind Contra on Virtual Console? What is the idea of a policy like this? Japan seems to get twice as many Virtual Console games as the rest of the world. Is this some kind of national bigotry on Nintendo's part? Take care of Japanese customers first? I'd like to understand, why does Japan get double extra special treatment? Isn't it about money? I mean, Microsoft and Apple don't treat us better, at least not on this level, from what I know. So what gives? Oh. This is a good. This is an old chestnut of a topic, but we've talked about this a few times over the years.
The Virtual Console. As far as the veracity of this story, I don't know. I have no special knowledge of the Japan Contra situation, but it sounds kind of like Miiverse Playground Scuttlebutt to me. It sounds like my uncle who works at Nintendo told me that.
This is actually a topic that I've considered in the past of like why, because I kind of felt like I would get, I had a Japanese Wii, mainly because it had a way better virtual console, just as Clifford describes, and I was interested in getting a Contra, or I think perhaps the very first Contra in Japan was called Grisor or something. at least some of the versions were.
I think I pulled one of those once.
I had one of those removed once.
That's what they used to call. That's what they used to call Donovan McNabb's sports hernia. But anyway, I always wondered why it wasn't there because I was kind of interested in getting it. And I kind of looked into it a little bit. So it's kind of serendipitous that we're doing this question now. There are extra things in the Japanese version. That is accurate. There are extra cutscenes, and indeed, specifically, it has kind of a precursor to the chip that was in Castlevania 3 cartridges in Japan that allowed for the superior music and the extra graphical effects. That was the VRC3. Contra in Japan has the VRC2, so it does have quite different from the other versions in that
way. So it could be an emulation challenge, is what you're saying.
Possibly, although the fact that I was going to come on to is the fact that we do have Castlevania 3 on the Japan Virtual Console, so you would think if they could do that, then why not do the Contra sort of analog there? But who knows?
Disc version, right? That's the original Japanese version with the extra channel and everything.
Well, no. These VRC chips are only in cartridges.
For some reason I thought the infamous Castlevania 3 was a disc system game.
It's because they would put these special controller chips in the cartridges themselves. That's what allowed them to do it. The disc system had an extra sound channel and stuff for games like Castlevania and Kid Icarus and all that.
That's a different reason we get crappier versions in America.
Yes, that's right.
Them confused sometimes.
But that actually went the other way with Simon's Quest, where the cartridge version in the West is generally regarded as having better sound than the disc system version does in Japan. So, yeah, there's some funny issues with that, but nothing about that would necessarily exclude it from being on the virtual console. The only thing, but this issue of these cutscenes, I'm not sure. I mean, Contra's always been a little bit dicey about IP infringement with its naked kind of Predator and aliens and Terminator references and stuff. But Contra Spirits is on the virtual console. That's full of play. There's pretty much the
Contra 3 as well.
Yeah,
it's all in the fair use area, though. It's not.
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm saying I don't see what in the first one would have been, any more kind of dicey that would have meant that they would be sort of iffy about bringing it back. But having said that, I've not actually seen these cutscenes that were there, who knows? But the problem is, that's what we've always talked about virtual consoles. It's so not transparent. it's really difficult to kind of guess at what the drive some of these things, because you don't know.
Why did Earthbound never come out on Wii Virtual Console?
Until now. I mean, there was a lot of theories. There was a lot of theories about that, of like, oh, is it the music references, artists,
but
they'd be worried about.
It couldn't have been that, because they didn't change the music at all when they did finally bring it out on Wii.
No, exactly. People always speculated maybe you'd do so, but then it never. So exactly, and that's the fact. I mean, Earthbound has come out mysteriously all these years later. We're not really any closer to knowing why it didn't come out earlier than we were. It's very I mean on the issue of just the general point about the Japanese virtual console, I mean, this is something we've talked about before hundreds of episodes ago now, but I think that the key, there's a couple of key things. First of all, there are many games in Japan that that get on the service that really can't come out here. you know, like, say, for instance, all the kind of Shin Megami Tensei games that were old that never got localized. Scores of Japanese RPGs and
things that simply can't just be released.
Visual novels, all that kind of stuff. Yeah. They never got localized. Maybe there's fan translations out there, but that's a whole, you know, it's not just a kind of... So they have all of those sorts of things that were popular over there that, you know, people would be interested in buying on virtual console that they can release there, they can't release here. And the problem is that...
Densha to go and, you know... I think a lot of it, in you know, there are some very well-known games that were released in the West originally that probably don't have much of a chance of coming out because the, let's say, the Western rights to publish those games are wrapped up in shell companies that have purchased the, you know, the rotting husks of old 80s game publishers. And so in a lot of cases... The people who own the rights to do that stuff may not even realize it, or they may have it, but they don't care because all they do is release phone games, you know. So that stuff makes it really difficult. If the rights don't revert back to the original Japanese publisher, then you can be in a lot of trouble. And even if they do, the Japanese publisher may just not care or may not have the business infrastructure to do Western releases. And I think on PlayStation Network, there's a company called Gaijin Works that Monkey Paw, I think. Monkey Paw, that has released a lot of Japanese games and even some localized versions of games that that the original publisher either doesn't exist anymore or they sold them the rights and they allowed them to do the so-called distribution digitally. But they found a way to make it work. And I don't know if Nintendo is just not as interested in that kind of a deal, but it doesn't seem to happen much.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we do get import games. I mean, that's happened. So it's not as bad as it could have been. You know, games typically that you don't need a lot of text knowledge to deal with, have come over. But the real issue with this disparity for me is just the fact that there are, of course, a great number of games during the NES, especially the Super NES and the Mega Drive and all that, that were mostly popular in America and Europe, but we don't see them come out here. You know, our equivalents of games like Shin Megami Tensei, you know, the games that were made here in the Western part of the world that were for our markets, that were popular here. Maybe they were released in Japan, but if they were, they weren't terribly consequential. But, you know, it doesn't swing both ways. That's the problem.
It's weird, I mean, there's 100 versions of Madden and FIFA and, you know... What am I thinking? There's the King's Quest for NES. That's never coming out. I mean, there's no reason it couldn't, but it's just not, you know, I don't think American publishers really.
The interest isn't there.
Well, I don't. It may be the interest, but also, I don't really think American publishers really kind of have the inroads to do this. I think, you know, we've talked about this before. I think Virtual Console is run almost entirely out of Japan. I think, you know, NOA and NOE have very little influence over what games are available for them to release because the emulation is done in Japan. And I think a lot of the setup and the business decisions are done in Japan. So I don't, you know, if EA wanted to release The Immortal for NES on Virtual Console, I don't even know that they could. I mean,
it's not been the red carpet's not been rolled out enough for them to feel like it's worth
they
doing.
They may very well not even understand the process of how you would even begin to go about it.
We can only really speculate because it's not something they've talked about a lot. But I mean, the point is, there were Commodore 64 games on the Virtual Console, you know, obviously. So, which is kind of like analogous to Japan having MSX games a little bit, you know.
That's
so
fair. Yeah.
They it's not totally one sided, but when you add it all up, that's why the Japan Wii Virtual Console has nearly 650 games. And then, you know, it everywhere else is lucky to get, you know, about half that. So
300 or 400, I think, in America.
Yeah, it's you know, a bit over half, but you know, not by a massive amount. So I think that's the main reason, is just the fact that, you know, these games that would be kind of more attractive, you know, specifically, you know, appealing to the sort of nostalgia of, you know, our markets. You know, so, like you said, old EA, you know, you could have the NHL games, you could have the old Maddens. I mean, the old Maddens didn't even have a license or anything like that, you know, so I can't imagine it would be
fairly easy to do. Yeah,
I mean, but they're not not interested. Now, the other part of it that I can only wonder about as well is, and this seems to have only sort of magnified with the Wii U Virtual Console and maybe the back end of the Wii Virtual Console, is just that they do seem more interested in kind of pumping games out in Japan, say, multiple games a week. You know, not just that they have more of them to release, but they seem to be more willing to kind of say, mm-hmm. all right, well, here's three. Or certainly at its apex in Japan, you could get five or six, you know, in a week, which was never that common here and certainly trickled down to one.
It did happen in the early days of Wii, like early 2007.
Yeah, when they were building...
There were three or four coming out a week, and I got into a rhythm where I was going to buy at least one of these every week. It would just be, you know, which one of these do I like the most, or which one am I the most curious about? And it developed certain habits of me wanting to buy the games, even if, you know, none of the particular group that came out were, like, among my favorite games. I mean, I bought World Heroes at one point for Neo Geo. Oh. I don't care about that game, but I remember liking it when I rented it when I was 12 years old, you know? There's a lot of weird stuff like that that I was willing to go out on a limb for, but when they're trickling them out one a week, I take a hard look at that one game that's available
this week. Which is interesting because you've got to wonder.
I don't really want that one.
Which is interesting because you got to wonder whether that's exactly the opposite sort of behavioral response that they're looking for. You know, it's like, well, if we drip feed it out, then people get desperate and say, you know, give me Renegade.
Maybe I treat it very differently, but I bought a lot more Virtual Console games back when they were releasing a lot more of them, and it's cut off to almost nothing now.
I kind of stuck with it, and I had the Japan Virtual Console that got plunder, so my experience was quite different. But yeah, I mean, even me, I would say it was kind of more front-loaded. But yeah, I mean, I just think if you look at it the way that they're different, it may tell us something just about you know, the actual the markets, in that you've got to think, I mean, you know, as Clifford says in his letter about, isn't it all about the money? Well, yeah, I mean, and you do have to wonder just about whether they've looked at spending patterns in Japan, they've looked at spending patterns elsewhere, and that's why they have these sort of different approaches. The market could sort of support these, you know, three games coming out in a week on Wii U. And very often, actually, if you look, it tends to be that they might put, say, one Nintendo game out, but then you'll have a PC Engine game to sort of complement it, and then an MSX game as well or something. That's kind of the way it's going at the moment in Japan on Wii U. So they're still kind of, see, I still feel like they've taken an overall lesson from the original experience, for whatever reason, that we want to drip feed it more than we did before, which, you know, the wisdom of that, I don't know. But they're kind of willing to add on, like, non-Nintendo stuff as, like, an appendage to that. And again, the problem mm-hmm. is that there's just less non-Nintendo stuff. There's always been less non-Nintendo stuff on our Virtual Consoles, America and Europe, than there is in Japan.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. You have to think, like, when they started to kind of drip games out as opposed to sending them out two or three at a time a week, at some point you have to think that sales must have just fallen off a cliff, to the point where it just didn't make sense for them to keep flooding the market with these games. So
didn't make sense for them to even include internet capability in the console at some point.
Yeah, the Wii Mini. So I mean, I guess, yeah, that you're just looking to cut costs any way you can, and at that point you feel the people that are getting it are like,
you're
super...
just looking to cut price too, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you cut the costs in order to cut the price. But yeah, I mean, you have to think some of this is market driven, and perhaps in part this is an experiment, as well. An experiment's been going on for 5 years or whatever, but you know, like, about, well, you know, how do the sort of spending patterns change when you've actually got this kind of drip feed? You know, are you going to get, like, you know, the kind of the effect that Johnny was describing, when it's actually people get more engaged when there's a lot of games coming out, or do you get the people who are just desperate to buy anything end up, you know, being sort of effectively more thorough and not overlooking games because they came out in a group of four with, like, a bunch of really legendary high profile games, and so they got kind of passed over? So maybe they're learning more lessons. But I guess the other thing that's hard to get,
my gut feeling is that there's someone in Nintendo, probably NOE or Nintendo of America, who is doing the stats and is learning a lot about those patterns, but there's no one in Japan who's actually listening to that person's findings. I think this is a very open loop. I think someone is at behind the wheel. They're doing whatever they want to, or they're doing whatever they can get emulated, you know, as fast as they can. But I don't think the market research is driving the way Virtual Console works. It's too random and bizarre for that, and really counterintuitive, I think. So I can't believe that there's really a whole lot of intelligence behind this.
Whatever findings you would have would be, I think, you know, a bit less powerful, shall we say.
Say tainted.
They're less powerful because promotion, you know, the promotion of Virtual Console as a service, those games, you know, it was so poorly integrated into the Wii. You know, in terms of people could buy a Wii and probably not be aware that you could hook it up to the internet and get onto the shop and buy all these classic games. It's got all these classic games from the 80s that you know, and all that.
At least Wii U sent me a message saying, hey, Earthbound finally came out. Don't you want it? And I was like,
the thing. I mean, Wii U is sort of somewhat better integrated, but of course it has not achieved the popularity that Wii did. Right. But that's
and
the question.
Miiverse is a good way to discover that stuff, too.
If you were looking at, you know, if you had, you know, the sort of integration that the Wii U has applied to the moment of time that existed when the Wii was very popular back in, you know, 2007, shall we say 2008, you know, would the Virtual Console have been a much bigger, more mainstream success? It's hard to say. So, I mean, whatever sort of market data you've got, you know, without context, I still feel like the findings of it, you know, would be kind of dubious. And then, like you said, I personally, if there's a pattern there to identify, you know, I fail to see it yet. But, you know, like I said, in the end, I think the big thing to take away from it, though, is just that, you know, a lot of it is to do, in terms of the Japan-West disparity, is to do with the kinds of third parties that do have access to the Virtual Console, you know, and they are Japanese third parties, and they could seemingly, you know, they've got friends in the right places or whatever it is, and then they have the sort of ability and the inclination to kind of put these games into Nintendo's pipeline, whereas Western third parties who had games back then just don't.
Nope.
Well, apparently and not. You know, Western third parties wouldn't have had as many games that would have. They wouldn't have had as much of a back catalog as the Japanese companies.
There are some
very worthwhile games that are, you know, probably never going to come out, and it's
and again
mm-hmm.
you,
it's
you,
really
you,
too
you
bad.
Got you got some like Mega Turrican or something like that. You know, it's not like there was absolutely none of that stuff, but the Star Wars. Yeah, Super Star Wars or the indie game, or, you know.
LucasArts got involved really late. Those games came out like 2009 or 2010.
Zombies Ain't My Neighbors, yeah, that, you know, like there was some stuff. It was absolutely zero, but it was not as higher percentage as you get in Japan. Although even that's not nearly, you know, absolute, because like you said, sometimes the rights is just a nightmare and companies have gone defunct and all that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, they don't have all 1,000 Famicom games on Virtual Console, but they have almost all the ones you would want, really. Where you can't really say that in America. Or
yeah, licensing, of course, is licensed games is always a problem. You know,
sure.
You
get
old sports rosters because...
And there was,
you know,
plenty of Western
with,
games that were licensed, you know, so there's that.
Yeah. All the NFLPA stuff and all stuff that would have expired by now, all that kind of crap.
I think we only ever got the one Ninja Turtles game, didn't we?
Yeah, which had a little premium charge on it for the licensing.
Right, yeah. And there were three for NES and at least two for Super Nintendo, including the fighting game, which is surprisingly good.
Yeah.
It's really a shame. But Virtual Console continues to be a complete enigma to us and all rational thinking beings.
But hey, so let's, you know, move on. Gargoyle's Quest 2. We're one step closer.
There we go.
We're one step closer to Demon's Crest. It's still possible.
I'll believe it when I see it on my system.
Yeah.
I'm still waiting for that one. But let's move on and have John read the next email.
All right. The next one is from Delaney in Las Vegas. Delaney writes, I was talking with my cousin about Namco making Smash Brothers the other night. Well, maybe not making it completely, but they do have their influence. And I was wondering if we should be concerned about this. With them helping make Smash Brothers, we can only expect that Pac-Man will be in it. since that is Namco's main mascot, also looking over Namco's game list, I think there are some of the most hilarious things.
It's going to be the car from Ridge Racer.
And most terrible-sounding games in their roster. Pac-In Time comes to mind, which I believe that is the greatest, but also the worst title ever. Also, with them making Tekken, will we see those characters pop in too? It's making me think this might be an even more diverse Smash Brothers game than Brawl with Snake and Sonic. Also, they make Soul Calibur, so what is the chance that we might see see characters like Ivy and Nightmare in Super Smash Bros. 4? Regardless, I guess my ultimate question is, with games like DC vs. Mortal Kombat or the Capcom vs. games, do you think that this Smash Bros. Could become Nintendo vs. Bandai Namco? Also, do you think that we will see a lot of Namco characters bleed into Super Smash Bros. 4?
I could see a couple. You know,
yeah,
I think Pac-Man is
a
lock. I'd be shocked if that doesn't happen. And, you know, pick your most iconic Tekken or Soul Calibur character, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that. I mean, obviously, don't forget, not that they have, like, Namco's IP to draw upon or anything, but, I mean, the last Smash Brothers game was outsourced to Game Arts or whatever. I mean, the fact that Smash Brothers is sort of being outsourced with Sakurai overseeing it is nothing new.
Right.
And you know, there were probably other prospective developers that they could have gone to, and this was just the best fit. So I think
I'd say Namco's far more qualified than Game Arts to make
games, presumably.
So.
I mean, you'd have to think so. I mean, the point I'm making is that it's still the same project, whoever you give it to, so it's not going to be fundamentally different, like we're going to have a shitload of these characters and it's going to be like a versus game. But yeah, it would seem silly or almost like a snub, a slight, not to have Pac-Man or maybe one or two others.
I mean, they put Link in Soul Calibur 2, so
yeah,
I
return
fully
in the favor,
expect
yeah.
at least one or five Namco characters to show up in Smash Brothers. Mm-hmm. And that's fine. I mean, that's what that game's all about.
Issue of the size of the roster in general, isn't there? I mean, you know, it's already pretty big, and they haven't even officially announced Yoshi yet, although they probably will have done by the time people hear this. But,
right.
you know, like, it's going to be pretty huge. You know, and I don't know how, even though Sakurai sort of is ominously said, like, oh, some of your favorite characters might not come back from previous installments, so... I don't know how big it's going to get, but... you know,
I'm fine with that, though. As long as they add a bunch of new characters, then I don't really mind if they cycle out some of the old ones. You know,
the new characters so far look really, you know, distinct. And, you know,
and
like,
Mega
really,
Man,
really cool.
I still am super pumped about.
I mean, is anybody going to cry if Star Wolf's out?
No. I mean, that's the really low-hanging fruit, Falco, Wolf,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
And
Ganondorf, frankly, I'd be quite happy to lose
him.
Well,
I think they should just make Ganondorf his own character.
Yeah, if it made him different, then yeah, go for it.
Yeah.
But the last thing Smash Brothers needs is any Star Fox characters, let alone these Star Fox characters.
Yeah.
By the way, that was, if you're not 100% sure, Tourney fans, that was a jab at you. Just to make it perfectly clear.
Oh, but he was so subtle, James.
I don't want any ambiguity. I want you to know you're ruining gaming. Moving on.
No, come on. Hey, you know, someone else wrote in kind of talking about Smash Brothers being in Evo and some other tournament too, I think. And, you know, and they were kind of like, suck it, you know, Smash Brothers is a tournament game. And you know what? I am completely fine with Smash Brothers being a tournament game. I don't like the way that it is played at tournaments. The setup for the games, I think, is really bullshitty. If they played with all the characters and all the stages and all the items, I think that makes for a great tournament game. I've played in tournaments that were like that and did well.
I would be
so,
fine with that, but that's not what they do. And
right.
if you turn
no,
off the
I
items
agree,
and
think...
you only turn off no hazard stages, you're not playing Smash Brothers. Just go play a fucking second
game. You're playing
game.
A really dull version of Smash Brothers, in my opinion. I'm just saying, I think in principle, Smash Brothers could be a great tournament game.
Yep.
It's just not in the present.
Well, and that's
form.
What I say when they're ruining it. That's what I mean.
Yeah, they just try to take away that random element, which is what Smash Brothers is all about.
That's what makes it fun in the first place. Yeah.
Yep.
It's crazy.
I want the bombs on. Yeah. I want hot bombs set to high and only items. That's a tournament.
No, bombs and footballs.
There's your turn.
I'll say again, I'm very glad that people have the settings available to them so that they can set up the game however they want. But it does not interest me in the slightest. And if that's what tournaments are about, then tournaments don't interest me in the slightest. And I think that's too bad. Because I think Smash Brothers is very competitive with everything turned on.
I mean, it has a tournament mode built into the game.
And I've used it, and it's great.
And it works. You know? It's cool.
I think it's sad that the tournament scene for Smash Brothers is railroaded into a very, very narrow corner of the design space of that game and the fun, you know, the fun possibilities of that game.
And also Fox is an incredibly boring character, so to be fair. He's super fucking boring.
Yeah. But no, I don't think you have too much to worry about with Namco being involved here. And in fact, if anything, it's probably a good sign, I think. More crossover, it's gonna happen. You know, Mega Man's in there already. Sonic will probably come back. Snake, I'm not so sure about, but you know, nothing would surprise me.
Isn't Sonic
really
already coming back?
Is he already announced?
I thought so. Yeah.
Well, I'm not following it really closely, but yeah, I would fully expect him to. I would love if they got Square Enix on board and threw in a couple of Final Fantasy characters or something, and that could totally happen.
Even if they just threw him in, kind of like they did. With like the Mario sports games, where they threw in like the generic classes.
Oh yeah, that's because they made those games, obviously.
Yeah, they did. Sonic's in there. Cool. But actually, I mean, it just makes me think of like the Dream Mix TV World Fighters, where it was
Optimus Prime. That game is really cool.
Optimus Prime
it's not
and
as
Simon
good as Smash
Belmont,
Brothers,
right.
But it's really fun.
Oh, it's just way dumber than Smash Brothers.
It's hilarious. I have played that game with Ty Sugar, so I can die happy.
There you go. I mean, like I would absolutely be on board for them just having the car from one of their racing games stand up and punch you with its wheels.
Wasn't there a Sega game that did that?
There is a Sega game that does, like, you fight a fire engine.
Oh, that's Fighting Vipers, maybe.
It's Fighting Vipers.
Character
Jesus.
Roster.
Oh,
God. Yeah, Fighting Vipers is some... Whoa.
That's... Oh, yes, outsource this to the Fighting Vipers team. Yes, yes, I want that. Super Fighting Vipers. Yes!
Why don't we move on to the next email, and it comes from a Daniel in Australia who writes, before I get to my question, I just want to say to James, back off from Final Fantasy Mystic Quest.
It's bullshit.
You guys in the U.S. may have been lucky enough to get the main Final Fantasy games.
We weren't lucky enough to get the main Final Fantasy games.
We got some of them.
Got more
but down here,
than Europe and Australia.
That's fine, but we still missed a chunk of them.
But down here in Australia, Mystic Quest was the only Final Fantasy we got before 7. It was a good my first RPG. It served its purpose on me and got me heavily invested in RPGs from then on. As after that, I played Secret of Mana, Illusion of Time. That's the same game as Illusion of Gaia.
Yep.
And all these Super NES RPGs I could get my hands on. It's not a great game, but for what it is, it's a good game. Anyway, now for my question. A common argument I see people lobbying against Nintendo is that they never make new series and rely too much on older games. I always wonder why people say this seem to forget about the Nintendo eShop. What about games like Dylan's Rolling Western, Steel Diver Subwars, Pushmo, Sakurai Samurai, Harmonite, plus many other eShop originals from them? Or big console games like Xenoblade, Endless Ocean, Wonderful 101, etc. Is it just because these games come from lesser-known Nintendo studios and not the main big ones, like EAD and Retro? Or is it just because many of them are smaller, more experimental games? It just annoys me that I see a lot of it online of people saying they want to see Nintendo do smaller games or something new when they do a lot, and yet no one seems to give them credit for it. Nintendo is in an amazing situation where they have 30-plus years of history to draw from, and if Microsoft or Sony had the same, they would go to the well a lot as well. So why is it people seem to constantly bag Nintendo out for this, despite the face, it's not true at all? Despite the fact, it's not true at all.
I would say, ultimately, Nintendo themselves doesn't do a good job talking about those games.
I agree.
They seem to really soft sell them.
Well, I mean, they only released them on the eShop, which is fine, but it does it does sort of give this kind of, like, we're segregating them to this low risk area. We're not putting a ton of.
What if they did one of those?
Or we may never bring this over from Japan, but we'll let you know about 2 years from now.
What if they did one of those, like, Xbox Live Arcade collection discs where they could put it out at retail and it has, like, 5 or 6 of these smaller games that they've released And it's hey, plebeians, you know, check out this thing that you have no idea what it is, but at least it looks like a good value. It gets these things out there. It maybe establishes some kind of smaller franchises.
Well, they did that. They sort of did that with Freaky Forms in that they did like a bigger version of it as a retail game.
True.
So, I mean,
Freaky Forms, quote, deluxe.
Not a compilation, obviously, but I mean, there's a few different levels of which I look at this. I mean, yeah, there's the eShop stuff. James, but they're kind of, you know, I hesitate to say ghettoized in the digital area, but you know, like it's not as bad as it was when it was the Wii Shop and DSi.
Right.
You know, the eShop is much better run, better promoted. There's
better
sales,
everything.
It's better integrated with the overall firmware and all that kind of stuff. So it's not as bad. But I mean, there's another way to look at it. Obviously, just talk about digital games. Talks about stuff like Xenoblade and all that. But I mean, you go further back. I mean, for me, some of the problem is that people fixate on characters. Like, you know, Donkey Kong Jungle Beat is new. It just has Donkey Kong in it.
Right.
You know, it's not DKC.
It doesn't play anything like any other Donkey Kong game.
It doesn't have to be a Donkey Kong game. They just made it a Donkey Kong game because, as the letter points out, you know, they have this 30 years of history, you know, to draw upon, and they did. But the actual...
When they do that well, it's refreshing.
The content of the game, you know, is not like, oh, well, this is redundant. I've played Donkey Kong Country, you know, I've played DK64. You know? I mean, like, no, it's totally different, and it was original. WarioWare would be another good example. I mean, you know, it's got sod all to do with Wario, really. It doesn't play like any Wario games, but they just, you know, the developers of WarioWare had worked on Wario games, so they put him in there and it probably helps sell it a bit, you know. So, and then you get the games that just don't have characters. You get the Wii Sports, the Wii Fits, the Nintendogs, you know. These were huge games, very popular, and they put a lot of marketing behind those. You know, so the idea that they're just sort of only been recycling the same games over and over again, like since the 90s, is definitely a fallacy.
Right.
I think what you have seen...
Well, it's easy to reinforce nowadays just because of the higher profile games that they're releasing seem to be very similar.
Well, sure.
I think what's happened in more recent times is that the higher profile games have been getting more, you know, towards, you know, obviously, you know, New Super Mario Brothers, Donkey Kong Country Returns. Yeah, then it's getting... Nowadays, I think the highest profile games do reinforce that perception, but it is a very surface level. I mean, Wonderful 101 that's brought up in there is an excellent reference point,
right?
Because apparently they had the option of making that an all-star Nintendo thing and decided against it. So, you know, I mean, there they actually will, you know, very deliberately chose, no, we want this to be its own thing. We want it to be more fresh. And obviously it did not sell very well in the midst of the Wii U's general sort of soft landing. You know, so it may not have been that consequential, but they still, you know, they got Platinum to make themselves something, you know, refreshing, something different for their console with new characters in it. And then, you know, obviously Xenoblade is a bit different because they actually own Monolith.
Right.
So, you know, that's very much their game. And then X and stuff. So, I mean, if you're willing to go even somewhat below the surface of it, you can see that it isn't just, you know, this is all they do. But, you know, I would say that in the past, you know, since the DS Wii sort of apex, the games that they've trotted out as being their money makers have got more conservative. Because, you know, really sort of after New Super Mario Brothers on Wii, that was kind of where it started for me. That, you know, that was very successful. Probably also Mario Kart as well. And so they kind of double down a little bit on that strategy, and those have been the games that they've been pushing the hardest, and so I think that's what contributes to this idea.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the thing. It seems that the games that they push, I mean, you know, 10 years ago, you know, it seems that the types of games that they pushed had, you know, kind of a wider variety. So it just seems like they, you know, they almost soft pedal games that aren't from certain genres. And really, like, you know, from, you know, even games that people are really looking forward to, people, no one can understand. I mean, we've talked about Nintendo's marketing forever. You know, again, no one really understands why they market certain things, why they market the hell out of certain things and leave other things to die. So,
it's their kind of weird, like, this, I don't know, it feels very much like they market the things that are relatively low risk. I mean, it's it's kind of a weird backwards investment, stuff that you don't really need to push.
It's very similar with sort of these blockbustery type films, isn't it? You know, yeah. They're the ones that always have the huge marketing budgets, and you think to yourself, well, do they need them? Like, you know, it's got a bunch of stuff blowing up. Don't people love that?
But, yeah, and that's a change, though, because they never used to be like that. They used to say, this is our big game, and it could be something, you know, something wildly new, something you've never seen before, and they would peg that, this is our big game, and then they would market the hell out of it, and they don't seem to do that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of it is because they make more games, to be honest. I mean, if you go back to the Super Nintendo era and sort of work your way on... Yeah, I mean, the fact is they didn't...
They're the only ones doing it. So, yeah,
I mean, that's part of it.
It's pretty high. It's still not as high as we would like, but yeah, compared to, you know, back in the day, it's absolutely... And they've gotten bigger. I mean, there are more game developers working now at Nintendo than ever have been.
Yeah.
No, this is the point. I mean, when they, when they were making, you know, relatively small number of games on the Super Nintendo, you know, again, so that was more how you could get a case of, well, you know, this is Nintendo EA, you know, whatever it was called back then, R&D 4 or whatever. You know, this is their next big game, and it would be something that was kind of different because, you know, it was just like, well, they didn't have like a whole bunch, like multiple Mario teams or anything like that. You know, they didn't have this kind of churn going on all the time, so it's not like well if you wanted to do something else, then so you know some other team can make the Mario game. That's not how it used to work. Whereas now, I mean, we see the situation with New Super Mario Brothers 2, where it's like, oh crap, we need more games on the 3DS so it doesn't die. Somebody scrape some developers together to make another Mario side scroller. You know, like that could not have happened years ago, but it can now because they have grown a lot bigger, and also just they feel like, you know, that is a high impact title, you know, the side-scrolling Mario games, which let us not forget they ignored for 15 years, you know, like and then you get
now they can't get enough of it.
And the thing is too, I think this is kind of part and parcel with how Nintendo has painted themselves into a corner with third parties, where they have to rely more and more on their internal development teams to keep a robust game library going. So they have to kind of recycle ideas more, and they have to tailor the designs that they use to kind of shorter development times and smaller teams and trying to get more done with less kind of thing. So it's kind of, I think it's an overall problem. You know?
But, you know,
yeah,
I mean,
in the process, they are, you know, because of the volume needed and the need to, I mean, I think they learned a big lesson from Wii where they made what, one or two WiiWare games ever. And I think they published very few. And even those were mostly farmed out to other studios.
Or old games that they'd already been made, like the art style, bit generation sort of.
You can maybe even argue Dr. Mario probably. But, you know, I think on both Wii U and 3DS, they've been a little more proactive in making games for the eShop and in support that directly, because and the ironic thing is on the digital platforms there is some third party support actually, or at least indie support. So it's not like the only games you can get on those services are the ones Nintendo puts out, but they're still supporting them, and that wasn't the case back in the days of Wii. And that's where you get a lot of these weird new, maybe they're franchises, maybe they're just kind of one off experiments. But I guess when I look at the list that Daniel from Australia kind of pushes off here, most of these I don't think are exceptional games, you know, and for me that's kind of part of the issue with them. I mean, I think Pushmo is pretty great. It might not be quite as wonderful as some people say, but I think it's really good. But you know, it's none of these are like really top tier series, even the ones that have gotten sequels. So I'm not putting them down. I think it's great that they're trying new things, even if they don't work 100%. But the reason that people aren't talking about them is because nobody thinks that Dylan's Rolling Western is a must-have 3DS game.
Well, and to be clear,
that's why they're not getting the larger exposure. That's why the media aren't really talking about these games, because they're kind of just okay.
Well, and to be clear, when these games, when people talk about Nintendo's next game, they talk about things from their big-name development teams, and these games aren't it.
Yeah, right. That is. I mean, that is a part of it as well. Obviously, you know, there was a time, and obviously, this was when it was when EAD Tokyo was a young studio, it had only just been formed. But there was a time where it did make Jungle Beat instead of four successive 3D Mario games.
Right.
You know, they probably could stand to diversify a little bit in terms of you know, what some of its headline teams do. But then the follow-through.
By the way, they didn't try to sell Jungle Beat, and nobody bought it. And that is easily one of the best GameCube titles. You know, so this has been going on for a while.
I'm very fond of Jungle Beat, but I guess the problem with that was also is in the midst of the GameCube's kind of death throes. You know, I mean, there was a lot of disadvantages there. But, you know,
yeah,
I think
it's that's a 2005 game.
This is what I was going to say, though, that you do have to, if you do say, you know what, let's have the, you know, the courage or whatever you want to call it to, you know, give task something like EAD Tokyo with making a new IP or at least something more substantially different than they've been making, you still have to have the follow through of say we're going to market it as our next big thing.
Right.
As like, oh, well, obviously it's not the next big thing because that's the Mario and the Zeldas over there. And, or even
right,
the
and
people
obviously
will be...
they didn't do that with Xenoblade.
No.
And I think it will be
interesting. Well, they
weren't
even going to bring it out if
exactly.
Europe.
Right.
I mean, so they wouldn't even let NOE show it at E3, for God's sake.
Yeah, I think the way that they handle X will be very interesting. And I think it will show a lot about how they think they – it will show a lot about what they think of their audience and how desperate are they to grasp onto any Wii U game that looks cool, even though their marketing research may show them that, hey, you know, not that many people play RPGs on this system. Well, there's not any to play. I'm very curious to see how they handle this, especially because it is a sequel or some kind of follow-up to Xenoblade. And Xenoblade, although obviously not a massive sales success, it did better than they expected it to. So do they think there's growth potential here? Maybe we do really get behind this, or they still say America's just not ready for this or whatever. I mean, they're going to release it. I feel strongly about that, but I am really curious to see to what degree they really get out there and promote it and make people think, hey, this is a big deal. Like, you should go buy, like, you guys remember back in 2002 when Metroid Prime came out, there was a very clear message, not only from Nintendo, but also the media, when you can presume that Nintendo planted it in the media, and among fans on message boards too, that Metroid Prime was the game that is worth buying a GameCube for. It is the game for people who weren't interested in GameCube before that. It is a game that everybody should play. And if I don't know if X is the right game to do that message with, but it seems like it might be. And that's the kind of thing they need to get out there and be telling people, because the fact is that, you know, the immense majority of their potential market for Wii U does not own one yet. And they've got to reach those people. They've got to get out and say, look, we've got this awesome game, totally exclusive to our platform, and it's not another Mario game. This is something that is different and that you will think is awesome if you just give it a chance.
Well, and to that end, they've already done more to promote X than they did for Xenoblade at all.
I mean, quite a few of these games, to be fair. But you look at Nintendo Directs, yeah, Wonderful 101's got a fair bit of coverage. Bayonetta 2's got a fair bit of coverage.
Oh, man,
if you compare that to the past, that's progress, you could argue. But the thing is, Nintendo Directs are
progress, but there's no results to, I mean...
No, and
I mean,
the problem
I think it shows how weak Nintendo Direct is. It's a useful way to announce things. I don't think it's a very good way to market things.
I think it's a very nice format for glorifying press releases and for talking to, you know, because I mean,
press releases don't sell games either. Really.
No, yeah. Exactly. You know, and of course, you know, for the people like who are really engaged, it's very, you know, fun and interesting. But if you're going, you're trying to reach further than that, then that's when you do have to kind of, you know, and that's really what we're talking about. You know, I mean, Harmonite and so on is in Nintendo Direct, but you're not going to necessarily have people being aware of it, you know, in more sort of mainstream kind of, to the extent that Nintendo marketing reaches out into mainstream sort of venues. You know, that is for the big games, the Zeldas and the Marios.
Right.
And that's the problem as well. I think, let's talk about this idea of following through. You know, if you said, well, this game that isn't Zelda or Mario is going to be our big thing and we're going to portray it as such, you have to actually try harder, because expectations have kind of built up now to the point of like, well, you know, that their big stuff is Mario and Zelda, right. So if it's not one of those, it's not big. So you'd have to shout twice as loud, so to speak, to achieve the desired effect. And that only kind of lessens their willingness to do so, because
they have to do that if they're going to grow ever. I mean, you have to create new brands and sell
them
to people.
But
no,
I mean, they have to fight with their own perception. They have to fight. I mean, what's funny is they'll get chastised in the media, including by us, for showing Zelda Mario again. Everybody, put your heads down. But then when they show something else, we're like, oh, it's not Zelda and Mario, so it's not a big deal.
No, I mean...
They have to balance it, of course. They have to balance their portfolio. But also, I mean, they have to be willing to get, you know, big media ads. They have to do the push. They have to, you know, really get out there and invite the media to come play this new game. You know, guess what? Most people, even in the gaming media, don't know what Xenoblade or X are. So if you really want some coverage that's going to get people intensely interested, especially... You know, your target market for that is probably pretty hardcore gamers who just may not own a Wii U yet. So I would, you know, have a big preview event where you have a whole bunch of people in there and let them play for 4 hours.
Ugh.
That's what they did with Metroid Prime 2. It was awesome.
It's good for you.
I don't know if that's really conducive to the even 4 hours. I mean... That's a slow burn.
It's better than showing 2 minutes of it in a Nintendo Direct video.
That's fine, you know? But honestly, if you're in the gaming media and don't know what Xenoblade is, you're not very good at your job.
I don't know. There is a certain sense that seem to dismiss anything that's a Japanese RPG these days, and it wasn't. And it was far from the most high-profile JRPG release.
Go back to the point of, if you're in the gaming media and you just dismiss out of hand, it's probably not very good at your job either.
I don't think it's dismissing out of hand. I think it's just ignorance. It's like, hey, I heard about that game, but I never
got around to
playing it.
Ignorance is a pretty good way to be bad at your job. That's a pretty good way to suck at your job, is to be stupid.
All right, by the way, before we move on, I just want to quickly say I appreciate Daniel's note about Mystic Quest, and I just want to say we got a lot of responses on Twitter, on Gaff, and our own talkback threads, emails. Lots
care.
Of people agreeing with me that Mystic Quest is fun and that it's good. By the way, Shaman Donald Mick on Gaff noted that the music is fantastic. I didn't even bring that up. But anyway, a lot of support for that game. And I'm sure plenty of people agree with you, James, and just couldn't be bothered to write in. But
because it's so self-evident, they didn't feel the need.
The Mystic Quest Defense Force is we rep.
I can't believe that it took 6 years to expose this fissure in the team here.
I will state unequivocally to the start of the point of the email, which is, we didn't get a bunch of Final Fantasy games because Square thought this is all we Westerners could handle. That should insult you.
They brought out six after Mystic Quest, and six is far more complicated than even four.
Yeah, I know, but they're like, oh, we get
so
four.
You're full of shit.
We can't give them four.
Well,
they didn't bring out six
in Australia.
That's right. They still think Australians can't handle six.
Yeah, I mean, the Virtual Console was basically the the first release in Europe, wasn't it?
I don't know whether there was there ever a dodgy PlayStation version or something? But
yeah, there was,
definitely Nintendo platforms.
I think there was that weird PSX collection that had, it was called Final Fantasy, but it had like a Chrono game on it. It was bizarre.
Final Fantasy Origins.
Yeah, it was super weird.
Yep.
Anyway, we can move on. I think James has the next very short question.
Square can't name their frickin' discs, man. Jason writes, with many games forever losing online content like Dragon Quest IX, Picross, and Fire Emblem Shadow Dragon. Oh, she's... Whoa, that's not a sentence. Fine. I was like, but where's the... All right, with many games forever losing online content like Dragon Quest IX, Picross, and Fire Emblem Shadow Dragon, what's going to happen to Dragon Quest X? Aren't there still a lot of people actively playing it on Wii in Japan?
Yes.
I was like, I don't know.
Yeah, but it must not be on the
is
on
it?
The Wi-Fi connection.
Oh, well, actually, no, wait. Does it have the red circle or the blue circle? This is an important detail.
Well, that was wasn't that for the pay and play or whatever.
Remember, this game is pay to play.
I assume this has been more about what how they run it on. Technically, it would be different.
Yeah, but I wonder if you had a subscription service, if Nintendo. I'm sure Nintendo knew this contract was coming up.
I mean, well, I don't think they're using GameSpy to do the online server matching.
I would imagine that Square Enix is running their own servers like they do for Final Fantasy XI and Final Fantasy XIV.
Yeah, that's why you have to pay for it.
Is there a crossplay between the Wii U and Wii version of this game?
I think there is.
That would tell me that it's probably okay.
Yeah, this game might be all right. I mean, of course, you know, they would prefer that you upgrade to the Wii U version. But a lot of
Nintendo
people have,
would very
but...
much prefer you upgrade to the Wii U version.
Square is probably hey, if you're paying us $10 a month, we don't give a shit what platform you play it on.
They get Final Fantasy XI around forever. They don't give a crap.
You have to think, though, at the same time, though, Square Enix actually gives enough of a shit about its online experience for its games that there's no way that they would put it on Nintendo Wi-Fi connection.
Really? What part of the first launch of Final Fantasy XIV tells you that's true?
Well, I'm talking about the service. I'm not talking about the games. I'm talking about the way the service is actually run. You didn't see Square Enix putting out friend codes.
Yeah, you did. Yeah, Echoes of Time did.
I mean, to play with Wi-Fi connection. But on their own games that they run themselves? No way.
Oh, yeah, sure.
I'm going to miss you, Echoes of Time.
That game, I think, it was really mostly set up for local anyway. I mean,
definitely.
It was nice that they added that as an option, but I think it was also like the third Crystal Chronicles game, and by that point, I think a lot of people just didn't care. Like, if you were still interested in Crystal Chronicles by that point, you were probably used to playing it locally anyway and had a group of friends who were down to do that. So I wonder if that's why that game, the online, didn't make as much of a splash as you might have expected.
I just don't think. I mean, that game just sort of happened and went away.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately.
It's weird. I never got the sense that it was awesome, but it is kind of odd that. I mean, the GameCube one is really good, and a lot of people really liked it.
So what essentially happened with that franchise is they made the GameCube one. It was really good, and I mean, I love that game. I love it to death.
It's super fun.
They made the two WiiWare games. So it sort of seemed like they decided this franchise is a little bit, you know, out there on the side. Then they made Echoes of Time, and it just sort of dropped it on the marketplace.
Wasn't there even one in between? Wasn't there an earlier one on DS? Am I going crazy? I thought there were two of them on DS.
Oh, my God. I don't remember a second one. Huh. I know.
Echoes of Time the one that was also on Wii, and like when you played it, it basically looked like a DS game on the Wii?
Yes.
Like it might have been emulating the DS game on a disc.
It's yeah, that's the one.
Also might have kind of tainted the release of that game. The bizarre descriptions.
Oh, you're right. Ring of Fates.
Okay, yes, good. I'm not completely
Ring
out of
Fates.
My mind.
Yeah, I forgot about that game.
Oh, good. My obscure Final Fantasy knowledge comes in handy once again.
What about your favorite Crystal Chronicles game, James?
I mentioned them in passing.
Crystal Bears. You never got around to that one, buddy.
No, we don't talk about the Crystal Bears in polite society.
Well, it certainly won't be affected. Actually, Crystal Bears might have had some kind of
online... It does not
have
Wi-Fi connection capability.
I was thinking it pulled down items or something, or leaderboards or something
weird like
that.
I don't even think
that.
It's on the box, the little, little logo.
Well, maybe not.
That's so cool.
God, yeah, I had blacked that game out until you came back, Greg. This is why we don't have you on the show more often. You're just dredging up bad memories.
I'm taking this knowledge to my grave, so you're going to do it too.
I'm going to go downstairs and find that game and scowl at it.
One day I'll be lying, dying on a hospital bed, forgetting the names of my family, but I'll remember that butt-bouncing crap, and I'll blame you.
Crystal Bears was on a retroactive poll at one point.
It
maybe
was.
A year or two ago. And I've never seen a game lobbied so hard in both directions as Crystal Bears. People jumping on saying, this game is so underrated, it's so interesting, you guys have to play it.
It's
and
super
other people
interesting.
Piling in to say, I will vote for anything other than Crystal Bears is a steaming pile of shit.
It is super interesting. My feelings about that game are incredibly complicated. But holy crap, does it play badly sometimes.
Yeah. I rented it from Gamefly, I think, and I played for like 2 or 3 hours. I was like, I don't know what this is, but I don't like it.
That game – this that was the game where when I review it, I said something like, I have no idea what I'm playing right now. Oh, that game also has the worst map in the history of video games.
I thought that was Mega Man ZX, James. You've made this claim before.
Why are you bringing these things up?
I'm starting to think you just like hyperbole, James, really.
This is my nightmare! Oh, I'm going to be mashing those games up in my head all night now. Oh, God.
Well, good news for you, Jason. Dragon Quest X seems to be okay, and maybe one day we'll get to play it.
Bad news for you, that game is
never
coming out of Japan.
So let's wrap back around to Greg for one last email this week.
Awesome.
Monsieur Wiener Wink writes...
Jesus. I didn't write this letter, I promise!
Winking with one eye, most certainly.
Shut up!
All right, you don't want to turn this into the bloody perfect dark theater again, do we?
Anyway, oh, God.
Completely agreed on Steel Diver Subwars. It was nothing to get too excited about, but it might be a nice second tier 3DS download title along with the underachieving Dylan's role in Western. Two but Dylan mentions in one episode. Very
good. Only on this show.
I did appreciate that Subwars came out of the blue, if you'll pardon the pun.
I will not.
And if you won't, get ready to not pardon a lot of the rest of this letter. If Nintendo keeps working on these secondary and tertiary franchises and allows them to be stealth hits, their quality will gradually rise, so hopefully more such titles will surface in the coming months. Who knows, if they keep improving, that people could be going nuclear for them in a few years.
I am going to drink myself.
And it makes me more excited about these Nintendo Directs to know that they're going to end with something that is suddenly available like this. You could say that they are homing in on a winning formula for these Directs.
Just no.
This is golden.
God. I'm gonna smother myself with a pillow while you finish this email.
Oh, come on, bring it on.
Maybe we should just end it right there, Greg.
Hold on to paragraph.
I don't really want to talk about Animal Crossing. I'm serious.
I'm glad you engaged in what is effectively guerrilla warfare with the English language. Screw your question.
That's podcast terrorism, Mr. Wink, and I do appreciate it very much.
I wonder if that's his real name.
Yeah, if that is your...
It's Werner, thank you. He's general.
Having had to deliver that, I'm going to exile myself from appearing on this podcast for at least another 6 months. So it's his fault. It's his fault. Not mine.
It's all your fault.
This is not my doing.
Oh, well, thank you very much for that, and from everyone who wrote in this week. We had a blast reading these and talking about them. So we read every email we get, I promise you that, and we get as many of them on the show as we can. So please send yours to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. We are still, as of recording right now, wrapping up the finalization of the retroactive nominees, but I think we're getting closer on that. So I said it last week, I'll say it again. I think we'll have it ready by the time you hear this, and hopefully you'll be able to vote. Look in the show notes, the article on the website, please, for a link to that, and we'll be hitting you up on the social media as well to let you know as soon as that's available. We'll leave voting open for a week or two to give everybody a chance. I know people don't always listen to the show as soon as it goes out, but please do look into that. We want you to participate, especially this time, because we have a chance to not only discuss a game with you, but also to play a game with you. With the Wi-Fi connection theme, and it's a limited time offer. We're gonna get to play these games, you know,
we will
for the
dirty
last
our
time
hands
on
once
the internet. So you know, it's our last chance.
Excite bots all the way. Yeah.
We hear Greg's vote. That one is certainly a possibility. So anyway, we're gonna hash that out amongst ourselves, but we're getting close, and I'm really looking forward to it. I hope, my fingers crossed, this shit will actually work. Because I want to play the games. I want this to not just be another hour of commiserating about how broken everything is.
Does anybody need to dig out their little Wi-Fi dongle thing from 2005?
Oh, God, yes.
We all have routers now. Hopefully.
We have actually added an unnecessary degree of difficulty to this retroactive and the real risk of failure.
Yeah, but the payoff is so worth it. So, hopefully.
Even if we fail, it's going to be an amazing segment. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, that's kind of my thinking as well. So, we hope you will participate in that. It should be a lot of fun. And finally, we got to thank Greg so much for being on the show this week. And Greg, is there something you might want to plug?
Is there? I don't know. It doesn't exist yet. That's all I'm going to say.
That's not till tomorrow. Come on.
All right, you're going to be that coy.
It could be just a flaming disaster, to be fair, so you do have to hedge on these things. So
we'll know by editing, so we can at least leave the "this could be a flaming disaster."
Not to mention it just could take a while to materialize.
Sure.
Yeah, that's fair. But anyway,
it's got to be properly vetted.
Suffice it to say, Greg is working on something interesting, I think, and it will involve some of us. and it's very different, and I'm looking forward to it a lot. So we will let you know when there are more details to be had, if and when. Say that. But in the meantime, Greg, we hope you will have fun playing your games, and we'll hope you'll stop by every now and then and talk with us about them, because you're so good at it.
And we hope we pick a Nintendo Wi-Fi connection game you can play.
I can play Zoidbots, though. I can, unlike most of my
Well, no, that, not necessarily because of region locking, but because of internet. And because
there is that, because
of GameSpy.
Well, there's also the fact that my serious point, joking about the dongle thing, is that my Wii doesn't play nice with my new router. So
of course it doesn't. It's 1999 technology.
Yeah.
Oh, we're going to get a letter.
All right. Well, more to come from that. But we certainly do look forward to having Guillaume back next week. And I think we'll have new things to talk about. NES Remix coming out pretty soon, I want to say. 2, the sequel. There are things coming out, including sales numbers. But we won't talk about that. We'll let that one slide this time.
Until you write us an email about it, and then we will.
Yeah, that's your prerogative. But anyway, thank you everyone for listening. We hope you had as much fun as we did, and we'll talk to you next time right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Later, y'all.